Can anybody hear me?
Yes, sir, Mayor, good morning.
Okay, thanks.
Good morning, board members. It is good to see each of you on this meeting, and in some of you I know are also there together. So I'm just getting, I want to get the green light that we are all set, Jeremy, and ready to go and begin the meeting. Just give me the sign. I'm going to try to get a visual on our board members. All right. I am not able to hear anyone, so I will ask if we are ready to go. All right, one moment, we'll check for technical issues.
Good morning. I'm trying to test my audio. Can you all hear me?
Yes, that's working well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
It looks to me like the audio and or the video, excuse me, in the boardroom is not coming through, so I'm going to go check that. I'll be right back.
Okay, Superintendent Hoffmeister, we are ready to go.
Thank you, Jeremy. All right, good morning, honorable board members and all of those who have joined us for this special meeting of the State Board of Education on July the 23rd, 2020. Let's call this meeting to order. Please call the roll, Terry.
Carlicia Williams-Bradley.
Here.
Kurt Bollenbach.
Here.
Bill Flanagan. He's just muted. He's present. Here. Estella Hernandez. Thank you. Estella Hernandez.
Here.
Jennifer Mennies.
Here.
Brian Bobeck.
Here.
Superintendent Hofmeister.
Here. All right. And do we have a quorum?
Yes, we do.
Did we comply with the Open Meetings Act?
Yes, we did.
And Superintendent, yes. Just real quickly, as authorized by the Open Meeting Act, Section 307.1, although the agenda does reflect that all members will be present through remote locations and video conference, as you see, we do have three members present. That is allowable. I just wanted to note that for the record. Mr. Bollenbach, Ms. Moneys, and Mr. Bobeck are present on site.
Thank you, and that will be reflected in the minutes as well. So honorable board members, I want to catch you up to where we left off at our last board meeting. A lot has occurred, and I want to share some of the good work that's going on. Engage OK on in the cloud this year was a great success. For the last 4 years, we've actually been on the road, but this year, due to the coronavirus, of course, it needed to be virtually available to teachers, and we were able to have so very many thousands of them join us. Wednesday through Friday, just of last week, our team offered 32 high-quality professional development sessions to 4,500 active participants. The most popular session was, I don't think this is a big surprise to anyone, but our student panel. It was called Student Voices, What's Missing and What's Needed. I had the pleasure and honor of getting to moderate that, and the discussion was robust and it was quite insightful. It featured 10 of our outstanding high school students who are on my superintendent's advisory council. We lean on the students and their voices throughout the year, and this summer we wanted to bring some of that to our teachers in the Engage OK seminar. Other popular sessions were devoted to our OK Edge virtual learning community, dyslexia, and early reading instruction. We are optimistic that next summer we will be able to connect with our teachers in person for Engage OK, but we are grateful to have offered meaningful professional learning opportunities to thousands of educators in this new format. So speaking of new format, this is something that we are keenly aware of, the digital divide. And we know that this faces our state and our nation. So our March 2020 technology survey indicated an estimated 167,000 of our students do not have adequate internet connectivity to support distance learning digitally. So we announced last week that the State Department of Education is offering 50,000 hotspot devices through a competitive grant process. And these devices will then be in a home where our students are able to connect after school or in the time of distance learning for lessons. Funding for this initiative comes from the State Department's set aside in the ESSER funds, which is part of the federal relief package. These hotspots will be provided to low-income students who do not have currently connectivity in their home for the purpose of distance learning. Those applications are due this Friday, and we expect to announce awardees at the end of this month. Also, I want you to know, speaking of surveys, that we continue to work with our districts as we prepare to reopen schools. We recognize the struggles to secure appropriate PPE. This is so important. To understand the magnitude of this issue, the State Department of Ed has sent out a survey to each district. The results of that survey, which closed yesterday, will be used as we work with the governor and our Oklahoma congressional delegation to help pursue opportunities to procure more safety and protective equipment for our districts to use. This is of extreme importance. As you may recall, Oklahoma used a portion of its CARES Act funds for ensuring that all districts would have access to a new tool called ExactPath, and it's new for some districts in Oklahoma. Others have been using it and have been very, very pleased. It's an online tool that combines adaptive diagnostics with individualized instruction and learning pathways to promote growth in math, reading, and English language arts. ExactPath is flexible and can be used in classrooms with blended learning and in distance learning. And actually, there's no cost to districts throughout the entire upcoming school year. To update you, we have 352 districts who have already shown interest in ExactPath, and 251 are already committed, and of that group, 172 are ready to deploy right now. It is not too late for districts to sign up, and we are encouraging them to do so just as soon as possible. So on these monthly updates, we often talk with you about wonderful people that serve in this building and in this agency. And I want to today bring forward a very, very special servant who has committed so much of her career to the state of Oklahoma, to educators, and to the children in classrooms all across the state. I've always heard you say that you should save the best for last, so here we go. In just a few short weeks, a legend in Oklahoma public education, Dr. Cindy Koss, will be retiring after more than four decades in public education. And there is no one more deserving of a blissful retirement than this stalwart champion of public education and Oklahoma children. I want to share with you a proclamation that Dr. Cindy Koss, you will have, and it is something that we want to read the proclamation. So our viewers who cannot see this and read it can hear through our words right now. While first making it clear that no words on parchment paper can ever do the justice to her contributions, I want to read this proclamation. Whereas Dr. Cindy Koss, a native of Chicago, traded in the Windy City for the even windier environs of Oklahoma, where she was built, where she has built a sterling career in education and earned the respect of colleagues near and far. And whereas Dr. Koss, a deft musician whose instruments include piano, guitar, and the string bass, the latter of which she played in a folk trio in the late 60s, parlayed her love of music into a distinguished career as a music teacher in Indiana and Illinois. And whereas Dr. Koss and husband Ray eventually moved to Oklahoma, where she taught gifted and talented education in Edmond Public Schools, was named Edmond's 1992-93 Teacher of the Year, and later took leadership positions in Edmond, Deer Creek, and Oklahoma City Schools. And whereas Dr. Koss has, during a long and illustrious career, influenced and mentored thousands of students and colleagues as a teacher leader. And whereas along the way, Dr. Koss earned two master's degrees from Oklahoma City University and University of Central Oklahoma, respectively, and a doctorate in educational administration and leadership from Oklahoma State University. And whereas Dr. Koss has served the state of Oklahoma with honor and distinction over the course of 17 years and two state superintendents of public instruction, and whereas after 40 years in education, Dr. Koss now embarks on a well-earned retirement where she and husband Ray plan to raise chickens, goats, and rabbits, and grow fruit trees and grapes. Therefore, be it advised that July 24th, 2020 is hereby declared Cindy Kos Day in the state of Oklahoma. I hope you will note that tomorrow, not today, is Cindy Kos Day. We do not want her to have to share the spotlight with what may become a lengthy state board meeting. If anyone deserves a day to bask in the glory of a long career, it is well-deserved, it is she. So truly, Cindy, thank you from the bottom of my heart for joining our team at the start of my term. And thank you for your incredible service to the state of Oklahoma and in serving two state superintendents of public instruction. It will forever be my honor that your last stop was as a member of my leadership team. Cindy, I would love to hear any words that you say as you may be here and able to address the board and those of us all across Oklahoma watching this who are great fans of yours.
Superintendent, thank you so much for your kind words this morning. I have always felt appreciated here at the State Department of Education. I also want to thank the State Board of Education. I have witnessed their thoughtful deliberations over and over again in order to support the students of Oklahoma. I've been honored to be a member of the state leadership team, and I've worked with many diverse learner teams over the years, and it's been a privilege to learn and grow alongside all of these people who always put kids first, and that's always been my belief as well. I appreciate the opportunities that I've been given to accomplish things with your leadership, and you know, the state standards, ICAP, diverse learners, and many more. Lots of fun. But I certainly know that everything is accomplished through teams, and I've been able to work alongside many amazing teams. And those teams have included not only those at the State Department of Education, but families and students and teachers and workforce and business and the Regents, universities, career tech, the list goes on and on. So it's really kind of bittersweet. I love this work and all the people that have given me these opportunities. And I know that challenges come and are met only with these teams. And we know we have one right now. But the most important thing to do at this point as I leave the State Department is to leave it in the hands of those that I've had an opportunity to work alongside, to mentor, because there are great people in this agency and across the state. And I thank you, Superintendent, for building that culture for leadership and for all these teams to develop. I know that it will continue to be great. So I will end by Margaret Mead's famous quote. I think it's appropriate here. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. And indeed, that's the only thing that does. So it's been an honor to serve in the state of Oklahoma. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Kos. And indeed, you have been a part of that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Superintendent, can I say something really quick?
Yes.
So I have had the pleasure of working with Dr. Kos on a number of things, including, you know, a lot of work that we all put into, you know, pathways and ICAP and trying to connect students to careers. We've traveled out of state to conferences together and done a lot of work, and I've seen her heart. I know that she always puts kids first, and I just want to say thank you so much for coming back, for being a part of trying to push, always push for the best interest of kids. So I didn't know you were retiring, and I'm sad, but congratulations and thank you for everything that you've done.
Thank you, Jennifer. It's been a pleasure working with you, and I think we moved some good things forward for kids. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dr. Koss. And we plan to continue celebrating. So tomorrow is your day, though.
Thank you.
All right. Very good. All right. Very good. Next, board members, let me draw to your attention the first item of action. It is item 3A, discussion and possible action on the minutes of the June 25th, 2020 special State Board of Education meeting. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Thank you. And a second?
Second.
Thank you. We have a proper motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, please call the roll to Madam Secretary.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. And now let's look at item number 3. It is also an action item. It is a resolution presentation and recognizing of Gina Nelson, 2020 Teacher of the Year. As many of you know, the Oklahoma Teacher of the Year joins our team for the school year and acts as an ambassador for teachers in Oklahoma. Gina Nelson, the 2020 Oklahoma Teacher of the Year, is with us today. But I want to tell you how she began her work with us just recently on July 1 and is spending the next 12 months speaking to groups of educators about her experience, partnering with the Oklahoma State Department of Education, and working on some very important projects and representing Oklahoma on the national level through the Council of Chief State School Officers, the National Teacher of the Year program. Gina, we're so excited to have you with us and look forward to working with you in the coming year. I wanna mention, Gina, that I also have something for you. I have a already framed right here resolution that we would traditionally present to you in person, but that's not possible today. So I'll read it now and we'll make sure that it gets delivered to you in person. And we hope that you will treasure this year as well. So a resolution honoring 2020 Oklahoma Teacher of the Year. Whereas Oklahoma Teacher of the Year Gina Nelson is a stellar example of the quality of education in Oklahoma, as demonstrated by her dedication and devotion to students and her deep knowledge of the art and science of teaching. And whereas Gina Nelson, in her capacity as an English composition and academic enhancement teacher of 7th and 8th grade students at Deer Creek Middle School in Deer Creek Public Schools, develops confidence in each child's ability, sets high expectations for her students and herself, and promotes active involvement in her students' learning in her own life and in her own way. Whereas she consistently exceeds expectations in teaching and in return, is earning the profound respect and admiration of her students, parents, and fellow educators. And whereas Gina Nelson will serve as Oklahoma's Ambassador of Teaching for the 2021 school year, sharing her knowledge and unique experiences with fellow and prospective educators while promoting education as a profession. And whereas in Oklahoma State Department of Education, we believe the future of our state depends on every child having the opportunity to achieve academic excellence, and wishes to commend and express gratitude to those who devote their lives to education of future generations. And now, therefore, be it resolved that the State Superintendent of Public Instruction and the State Board of Education do honor Gina Nelson and offer our congratulations on her selection as Oklahoma's Teacher of the Year and official ambassador for teaching for the 2021 school year. This has been signed, actually, by all of the members of the State Board of Education. And again, we're honored to have the opportunity to work together with you, Gina, and we will make sure that you get this on your wall. But I want to give you a moment to speak and address the board before we take up this resolution. Gina?
Good morning, everyone. Superintendent, thank you so much for those kind words. And to all of the members of the board, thank you guys so much. I am really excited about showcasing all of the amazing things that educators and students are doing across this state. We have a terribly difficult job this year, as you all know, but there is nothing that a group of Oklahoma educators cannot do. So I look forward to reaching out and seeing all of you either virtually or in person. And I am so excited to shine a positive light on our state at the national level. So to all of you, thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. And board members, have any of you had the chance to meet Gina Nelson already?
Yes, I have.
Absolutely.
I'm so impressed. And I appreciate your service, the true testament that you give to the passion and power of education through your own lived experiences, but also through paying it forward and serving our children. So grateful for you being on this platform and what you share and bridging that gap of opportunities for our students, really focusing on their holistic care. So congratulations again. I'm so excited about your leadership.
Thank you so much.
I had the pleasure of serving on the selection committee that you were in my group. And so I got to see your interview and go through that whole process with you and agree wholeheartedly with Carlisha that your personal story is incredibly moving. And I know over the next year, you will do a lot to talk about the importance of whole education for all kids. So thank you for dedicating your life this year to that.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Jenna, it's been such an honor to be able to get to know you. And I also sat on that committee with Jennifer Moniz, and I am just thrilled that our students are going to have such an ambassador like yourself. And these students are looking up to you, and to you truly embody that educator and that we want to be able to clone and multiply. So thank you for everything that you have done and that you will continue to do. And we're thrilled that that we have you as that ambassador for this coming year. So God bless you.
Thank you.
Outstanding. Well, thank you so much again, Gina. We are excited to get to work. So very good. Thanks for being with us as well. Now, board members, let's go ahead. Is there a motion for this resolution? And a second.
I'll make that motion.
Second.
All right. That was Mr. Bollenbach with the motion and a second by Ms. Moniz. All right. Please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley.
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, that motion carries. And we are excited to get moving as the school year opens. It's always exciting. And this is going to be a Teacher of the Year like no other year. And we need you. Thank you so much, Gina. Item number 3C is also an action item, board members. Notification of the dispensation of grades 9 through 12 by the voters of Panola Public Schools. I'm going to ask Brad to please take this.
Sure, Superintendent, board members. This actually is not an action item. Maybe that was a little extra caution that was added on there. It's not a required action item. However, with that said, administrative code does require that when electors of a school district vote to dispense with all or part of a school district, notification must be made to the State Board of Education. And so that is the reason for this being on the agenda today. On June 30th, the electors of Panola Public Schools voted to dispense with grades 9 through 12. And so effective this school year, Panola will be a K through 8 school district, no longer a K through 12.
All right. Shall we have a motion to approve that?
We don't need to?
Okay, then we will let that go on the advice of council. Let's turn our attention now to public comment, and I will ask our board secretary or legal counsel, is there any public comment?
Sorry, I thought Terry was going to jump in. We do have two individuals who have signed up to provide comments today. Jamie Murphy is present with us, as well as Carrie Phillips. They have signed up, and the time limitation provided on the 3 minutes.
All right, very good. Thank you. We will get our first public commenter ready. And would you please go ahead and state your name and where you live? Your town or your district as you begin to speak. Thank you. Is it Jamie?
Yes, Jamie Murphy. I reside in Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
Very good, thank you. And you may begin.
Okay, I'm not exactly sure of the procedure, but I just had a few comments if you'll give me that opportunity. Thank you. I've seen several states mandate for school to begin later in the year and offer the first 9 weeks as virtual. I'm not sure if that's something that's going to be considered on this agenda. I had read through it, but it wasn't descriptive enough for me to determine if it was going to be discussed. But from a parent's perspective, I'm terrified, as well as a lot of other parents are, of sending our kids to school. And a little extra time would be really beneficial. The virus is obviously no joke, and our teachers, as underpaid as they are, and our children who we trust in their care, deserve to feel safe. So I just wanted that noted, if you don't mind. In addition, the virtual period, if chosen, and the state chooses to mandate something like that, I wondered what kind of measures would be in place to ensure rural schools will have internet capabilities. I know you talked earlier about the MiFis or the sure. Wi-Fi's devices. I work with the American Indian Resource Center in Tahlequah. We're a nonprofit. We provide educational opportunities for rural schools and different locations in northeastern Oklahoma. And one of our schools, for example, in Kenwood, you know, has absolutely no service whatsoever. The only service you get is if you are already connected to like a fiber optic cable or something. So I just wanted the school board to consider that as well whenever you're making those decisions. And then lastly, I'd like for you to also consider what some other states have already chosen to do and not require state mandated tests. I know it's early. And we did it for obviously the spring semester. But after going to school board meetings for my district here in Tahlequah, it would really benefit the students if that's considered, because during that time in which they would normally be preparing for testing or having the tests that are mandated, they might be able to make some effort to catch up with those students on skills that they missed out on over the last few months. That's all I got.
Thank you so very much, Ms. Murphy. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And board members, we have Carrie Phillips with us. I will now turn it over to Ms. Phillips.
Hello, board members. My name's Carrie Phillips. I currently live in Piedmont, Oklahoma, but I teach in Middell. So I guess my concern is, as probably most teachers are, is the COVID. So you guys are talking about the Oklahoma Admin Code 210-35-21-2 today. And currently Section C says that online learning should not replace face-to-face learning. And in the spring, we saw that, yes, we had distance learning, but it was more of an emergency action plan. And I think that most people are scared of that plan because they saw what our emergency plan was. It wasn't necessarily what distance learning is going to look like this school year. And I think that the plan that Oklahoma City Public Schools put in their board meeting to implement online learning mandated for 9 weeks, it gives the teachers time. They did 3 weeks so that they could educate teachers and parents who were nervous about how they operate computers, you know, just basically their technology savviness and stuff. Because a lot of grandparents, especially in my district, raise their grandkids and they might not know how to operate that technology. And that fear can stop them from making the decision that might be best for their family just out of that fear. So we have an upward trend of positive cases and they continue to rise every day. I think it was 900 plus yesterday. And I just feel like pushing back the start date, especially whenever we don't realize that the flu season is coming up, I don't think that people are necessarily taking that into mind. We're going to hit flu season at the end of that 9 weeks. And I would like the opportunity for our schools to be able to still educate our students, still reach them, still, you know, monitor our high-risk students, monitor people who need further stuff, maybe even offer small group sessions in which they can come into school and get that kind of education and hands-on stuff because we're able to keep them in the smaller groups. My school district, there's no way that we would be able to do any social distancing. We just don't have the space, the amount of kids that we have in our school. It's just not feasible, and middle schoolers just, they don't stay away from each other anyway. They also say stuff, the CDC said that in 4 to 8 weeks, we would be able to, if we did safe social distancing and wore masks, we would be able to see a downward trend in our community. But in most of our, at least metro schools, and I would like to see it statewide, just because in the, I guess in the mode of conformity, but I understand that they are able in more rural places to actually create a safe social distancing environment that we're not allowed to get in, like, that we're not able to get in metros like the OKC Metro, Tulsa Metro. We're not able to space our kids out like that. And with the 4 to 8 weeks that would be included in that 9 weeks, it would allow us to see the downward trend. My biggest fear is that we've seen whenever we open the state back up, I mean, our cases just started skyrocketing. And I would like to see us have a downward trend before we put our kids back into the brick and mortar. A lot of people are talking about the psychological effects on children, and they're talking about psychologically kids need this, they need to get back to school. Well, what kids need is that physical and social environment to have a psychologically successful and developmentally successful year. That's not what we're signing them up for, because we're going to require them to wear face masks. And then we're going to require them to stay away from their friends. And we're going to require them to not be able to give hugs. You can't use manipulatives because we don't have enough to where everybody can have their own set. They can't share, which we've been telling them how long to share. And now we're saying, no, don't share your crowns with your neighbor. Don't play together. You know, on recess, you can't be close to each other. I feel like there are so many negative effects that this is going to have on their psyche, and we don't know how that's going to affect their development, because they're, I mean, we have kids who are going into pre-K and kindergarten who are needing that kind of a, like, they're needing those connections, and they're not going to be able to get them. I just feel like these are all things that can simply be avoided if we just took the time, if we just took those 12 weeks like Oklahoma City Public Schools did, the 3 weeks break, and then the 9 weeks, just everybody is committed to that. And then we could either, you could still either continue if you felt like you could handle that, or the 12 or the rest of the school year, the 3 semesters in which they could come back to the brick and mortar. I really worry about, like, the uptick with the Epic enrollments, just based off of what we have in place in districts right now. I mean, I just saw the Oklahoman reported there were 38,000 new enrollments for Epic. That to me speaks volumes as to what the public is wanting and what we're offering them through public schools. And that's all I have to say on that.
Thank you so much. Thank you. We really appreciate your comments.
Are we able to ask questions of our individuals who made public comments?
You may if you wish.
Wonderful. Well, first off, I want to thank Jamie and Carrie for taking the time. I think that hearing from parents is critical, and their involvement, because obviously it is their children that we are serving and doing the best, trying to do the very best for. So thank you for speaking this morning. It's beautiful that we heard someone from Tahlequah, from Northeastern Oklahoma, and hearing someone from the Metro, because those are two very vast different districts. And the concerns are similar when it comes to late start, when it comes to the tests, like Jamie mentioned, and also the virtual, as Carrie also mentioned. What I want to ask of the two of you is, have the conversations been had in your districts about a path moving forward? How would that look like? But because of this meeting this morning, one of the things that we are taking up are some of those requirements and safety protocols. And I want to know from the two of you, has the mask requirement been brought up in those meetings within your districts, or how you personally feel about it as a parent sending the children back to school?
Who's going first?
Miss Murphy, you sure may.
Okay. My children, I have two children. I have a almost 12-year-old and a 6-year-old going into first grade. Both outstanding children. My youngest is mild autistic. And we had our last school board meeting on Tuesday. And honestly, with a lot of the schools in my area, you know, we go to a rural school. It's Grandview School in Tahlequah. Everybody's in a holding pattern, waiting to see what the state is going to decide. And a lot of the schools I've recognized have put out specific procedures for coming back this fall. For example, ours includes masks for the students. I've been myself trying to find alternate ways to involve myself and my son's upcoming classroom, because I know for a fact that my youngest will not be able to keep that mask on, as you've probably seen other children try to do in the public recently. So I've looked for different alternative ways that I could help him both be safe and keep other children safe as well as the teachers. I've seen a lot of schools put together almost like barriers, and I kind of agree with the other speaker in saying that if our reasoning for sending kids back to school is to give them socialization, but yet hinder them with these masks and with potential barriers on desk and things like that. Though I would feel more comfortable if I sent my kid there wearing that mask and having that barrier, because I know that's going to keep him safe and potentially others safe. I still don't see the huge benefit. But yes, I think Cherokee County, I heard all the superintendents came together. They all agreed that they were going to wear masks in every school. They were going to do that as a requirement. And hearing from teachers, they're just as scared as I am and other parents are about sending their kids back. It's definitely a situation we haven't had in this generation. Nobody really knows the ending effects of it and what to expect. But all you can do is do your best. And I would say, for the most part, the majority of the individuals that I've spoken with and seen on social media would totally support more time before these students go back, because like she said, the state opened up and the cases went up. And in Cherokee County, that same thing happened with Memorial Holiday. With July 4th, the cases have went up, and it's the same everywhere. And if you compare that to other locations that have mask mandates and require a slower start to opening things up, the cases just aren't similar. They're lower, and it obviously makes sense not to send our children back too early, because they're important to us and they should be important to you.
Thank you. And is it Cassidy again?
Yeah, it's
Cassandra?
Carrie.
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. So I can actually speak for two school districts. My kids go to Piedmont Public Schools and I teach in Middell, so I am a parent. Masks are mandated in both. Middell, at our board meeting, we actually, they passed yesterday to purchase the gaiters for all of our students to make sure that they had the ability to have the masks in school. So I do think that the masks are a good idea. I do think that for kindergartners and pre-Kers, they're going to have a lot of struggles, a lot of slingshots, a lot of, you know, where's my mask and stuff like that. So having the extra PPE on hand for the school district is going to be necessary. I have a son who has severe asthma, so he will be attending online. Unfortunately, with Middell, even if I'm selected to teach online, because I actually have an autoimmune disorder as well that kind of scares me to go back to school with. And even if I teach online, I'll be required to teach in the building. So I will still be near the students. So it kind of defeats my purpose of teaching online, I feel like. But I just think that in general, everybody on the survey, we had a survey where we filled out, they did send it to the teachers and we voted on if we think that masks should just be for teachers, if they should just be for students, if they should be for both. It was widely voted. Every teacher put that both should wear it. I do think in order to be effective, it doesn't increase the effectiveness if only I wore a mask. It needs to be a mandate, like school-wide. District-wide or statewide. I just feel like we're really rushing into it, and I know that everybody's scared. I know that we want to make sure that we provide the best education, but the thing is that we really have to be considerate of is how many degrees of separation is that one kid in that school that rode a bus that isn't able to be 6 feet away from everybody? How much time before it's caught? Because in my district, and in Piedmont, we're trusting the parents to take the temperatures at home. So before that, it's caught that that kid has been even asymptomatic because he could still pass COVID around as asymptomatic. Before his test is positive, how many degrees of separation has he touched, been within these people, and how many schools are we gonna close down before it becomes where we're in the same seat we were in the spring and it becomes an emergency situation where we have to emergency close it down? At least if we gave ourselves the 3 weeks, we would already know how to operate it so that after those 9 weeks, if we did have a resurgence, all of our teachers would be properly trained, all of our parents would be prepared in order to provide those services.
Can I add something too?
Yes.
So Carrie's coming from a place where I guess you said masks are mandated in your location, correct? So Tahlequah, citywide, countywide, you know, we don't have a mandate for masks for the public. But I just wanted to reiterate the fact that the schools in Cherokee County have come together and agreed that everyone would wear masks. And in similarity to her, our students are not going to be required to take temperatures at the school in their expected procedures, which again aren't finalized because they were waiting on this meeting. What they're suggesting is that parents take the temperature of the children before they leave. And I agree with her wholeheartedly that you put a kid on a bus. And we already know that in regular session, in regular seasons, with flu, with colds, with what have you, parents still send their kids to school sick. Trusting every parent to do what they should be doing as a parent isn't necessarily going to happen. So you can definitely expect that idea and expectation of those parents to do what you want them to do is not going to happen. It's just not. Sorry, that's it.
Thank you very much. I'll turn this back to Brad.
Sure. Barring any other questions, board members at this time might move on to the consent docket.
All right, that's item number 5, board members. Is there a motion?
No, in reviewing the consent docket, I would make a motion to approve it with the exception of Noble's three-year request on the abbreviated school day. I would ask that that one be pulled and sent back to the district. But outside of that, I make a motion we approve the consent docket.
All right, is there a second?
Second.
Ms. Money's has the second. Mr. Bollenbach made that motion. Any further discussion? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, thank you. That motion carries. Next up is our item 6A. It's an action item, and I'll ask Miss Lori Murphy from our legal office to present the discussion and possible action on the adoption of the following emergency rules.
Good morning, honorable members of the board. And can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
All right, thank you. So our virtual meeting today is a perfect context for the consideration of your emergency rule for today, which is a further articulation of the guidelines for distance learning. So if you can see your rule text, this is an update to an existing rule from the 90s called Alternative Instructional Delivery Systems. And so what this update adds is content for the change in technology that's occurred since then, and the other new provisions that you'll see are exactly to address the distance learning that is what we're discussing today. So some of those highlights of the key changes, you'll notice terminology distance learning plan is defined in the new content. And as discussed, that is a method for schools to deliver instruction in a non-traditional setting. So as was developed in guidance this spring for schools developing their distance learning plan, there are a couple of key points that come up in this. And one of those is that the local board must adopt a policy authorizing a distance learning plan. And in that policy, one of the key considerations is equity. So that has been discussed already this morning a bit. And one of, I believe, the earlier issues raised was about connectivity. So one of the rule provisions for distance learning plans is that if a school district or a charter school implements a distance learning plan that uses virtual instruction, or that is instruction using the internet, then the school has to ensure that either all students have internet connectivity by providing devices and connectivity to those students who don't, or alternately, opportunities would have to be made available to students who do not have access. And we saw that this spring in the form of paper packets and those sorts of other workarounds for manually delivering that instruction. So this is codified guidelines for those equity provisions, also requiring policies to note attendance provisions and grading. And again, this is all content that was developed and should be familiar to schools already from the spring guidance. And this essentially places that into rule. So do you have any questions about specifics of this update, board members?
Is that they offer, they don't necessarily have to provide virtual instructions. Is that correct?
To make sure I understand your question, it is not required for schools to offer virtual instruction under this rule. If schools do offer virtual instruction as how they deliver their distance learning plan in an emergency, then they have to make sure every student has access to instruction, either by providing access to a device and internet free of charge, or by providing an equivalent alternative instruction, such as we saw in the form of paper packets this spring, or those sorts of manual instructional supports.
I'm sorry, Bill, go ahead if you had a follow-up question. I had another one.
If I take a school district, our normal school district, how does that rule apply to them as far as virtual instruction compared to EPIC?
Well, EPIC is a statewide virtual charter school. Those schools, the schools specifically sponsored by the statewide virtual charter school board, provide only virtual instruction. And that's the only form of instruction they ever provide. This rule is not an application to those schools, but in terms of virtual programs provided by traditional school districts and non-virtual charter schools.
But it allows normal school districts to provide virtual distance learning.
Yes. Now to clarify, school districts are already authorized to provide virtual learning to their own students. What this rule amendment does is provide for distance learning plans, which are those emergency scenarios like we're seeing during the COVID pandemic. It allows for virtual learning to be part of the distance learning plan that schools provide in an emergency. So again, to clarify, this is a separate issue from the general concept of offering virtual education. Schools are also authorized to do that. But the reason you're seeing this as an emergency consideration is to account for the current pandemic emergency scenario and anything in the future that would be something that needs to be responded to quickly to adapt instruction.
So in essence, we're operating under emergency conditions and therefore it'd be allowable for most school districts, is that correct?
Yes, under the rule, the provision is that if there's a declared emergency declared by a government entity, including this board, then that would trigger the authorization for school districts to implement their distance learning plans. So yes, essentially, this is exactly the scenario we're talking about.
Thanks.
And Ms. Bradley, did you have a question as well?
I did. I appreciate the rule revision addressing equitable access. I did have one comment in regards to where in the rule it states connectivity. I know as you were explaining it, I just want to be clear that connectivity means the device and internet connectivity. I've seen at times, you know, where students can be given a computer, but if they don't have access to the internet, that is null and void. And so just wanted to see if we could be more explicit in the rule in stating that necessary connectivity means internet and technology device connectivity.
Yes, we can make that insertion. The connectivity term was intended to cover the internet access as opposed to just the device. But what we can do is make an oral amendment right now to insert internet before connectivity where it appears in the rule. So that could be part of your motion if you choose to approve this rule is as amended verbally.
Okay.
Does that satisfy your concern about equity?
Yes.
Okay. All right, thank you for noting that. And are there any other questions or comments from board members?
Would that, does Carlicia's amendment, would that now just apply to internet connectivity and not the device, or is our intention that students should provide a device as well?
There would be a device as well. There is language in the rule clearly addressing that. There is just, I believe, one point that she's specifically referring to where it would be an additional clarification that that's an added requirement for the internet connectivity and the device.
Lori, yeah. Can you tell me what number is it? Like, where is the exact location in the rule that we're making the change?
Give me a moment, please. It is in section C1B, I believe. And there may be other instances. It is throughout, also in B1A. There are a few instances where connectivity is included when discussing the devices and access. And my intention, if I understood you correctly, Ms. Bradley, would be to insert internet before each of those instances.
Right. I think that it's implied, right? In intentions of how it was written and in our understanding, but just in order to be very explicit about the intentions of the rule, it would be great if we coupled internet connectivity along with technology device, so that that is very clear for those who are reading and implementing this rule at a local level.
Yeah, and we will go ahead and make that change in the rule if approved today, so that everyone can sort of read that as implied.
Ms. Murphy, I have a question. It's on page 4, item 3. I just want to clarify that we have just consistency across the board, because I see that the local school board is actually being crossed out and allowing the district itself. But then as you read further down, you're actually adding the board to the decision making there about the second or third sentence.
Yes.
So can you clarify on that? I just want to make sure that we're all on the same
page. The clarification there is so that it was not misinterpreted to understand that the local board would have to assign grades as a specific action, that is something that happens as an administrative action at the school district level in terms of awarding of credits. If that raises a concern for you about that language change, that could be adjusted to be the local school board and district, or district/board, if you'd like that to be specifically articulating the board involvement.
Correct, because early on we're taking out the board involvement, and then midway through we're giving the local district board the ability to take on that responsibility. So it just, in my mind, it just looks as if it's contradicting itself.
Okay.
But also within that, there's been internet-based that has been crossed out as well. So it just kind of goes back to
Sorry, if you'll note in the terms, the definitions, there was an old term for virtual instruction, web-based instruction. This rule was literally written in the days of the World Wide Web and, you know, AOL instant messaging. So there have been some terminology updates. One of them is internet-based has been updated in, I believe, most instances to virtual instruction, just to keep that terminology consistent with the updated language.
Great, thank you.
And that is also just to note for board members or anyone else seeing that, web-based is eliminated throughout and replaced with virtual. And that is an update and goes along with the definition update that's also in that rule.
Lori, I had a question.
Mm-hmm.
On page 4, number 4, where it's talking about students who are regularly enrolled in the school district, and then we're adding either as a resident student or transfer student.
Yes.
Can we talk through, I mean, it's my understanding that state statute does not allow for transfer students into a district to be transferred with a 100% virtual option. So I'm trying to understand, A, is that your reading of the statute? And then B, why are we adding here transfer students if that's not something that's possible?
Because that provision is not limited to full-time instruction, in part. Also, that there is a provision in law that currently limits transfer students who do not live in the district from being 100% full-time virtual students. And that does not apply to part-time virtual instruction for transfer students. I would also note, during emergency scenarios, a declared emergency, such as we're talking about for the distance learning plan authorization, transfer students would not be limited from participating in distance learning if that is delivered virtually. Just to make that clarification that, although there is a current limitation on full-time virtual instruction for transfer students, that would not apply in the emergency scenario where the school is not providing in-person instruction at all.
Okay, so under this, a student, if their home district is not providing in-person instruction, they could put in a request to transfer to a district that is offering a 100% virtual option?
No. There are no transfer rights altered by this provision. All this does is recognize that there is currently an authorization for transfer students to take virtual education. There has been some confusion about that. They are entitled currently to take virtual education in the district they've transferred to, although there is a remaining limitation on them being 100% full-time. So no one gets a new transfer right because of what kind of instruction their district is offering. Students who have already transferred to a school district don't have to leave the district if the district delivers their distance learning plan virtually. Does that make sense?
But if a student is in a district where they are not happy with the options that are being offered, they cannot transfer to another district who may be offering a 100% virtual option if their district is not.
That would not be relevant to this rule. They have no new transfer rights. If it's still the open transfer period, they would be allowed to make a request. Or if they have an emergency transfer basis for requests, they could make that request. But no, a student would not be entitled to change districts to change instructional plans.
Okay, thank you.
And does anyone else have any questions or clarifications?
Yes, I got. Just want to clarify in my mind is that if I have my school district and I have a transfer student, and by their choice, they choose to be 100% online because of special circumstances into that public school system, are they eligible? Are they not eligible for that to happen?
It depends on if we're talking about the emergency authorization and the distance learning plan being implemented. So under normal circumstances, there's no emergency. No, a transfer student can't enroll in a 100% virtual program. Right now, under a declared emergency, like the COVID emergency, then a student who has already transferred into a district may attend the program virtually 100% if that's the way the school is providing its education.
Thanks.
So it all comes down to the emergency scenario.
Lori, just to clarify further, that's only if they have already transferred in. Like they already have been accepted as a transfer, and therefore now under the emergency, they can participate in the 100% virtual option. It's just not open to any new transfers.
It is not intended to create a new transfer right, but there's also no authority to eliminate existing transfer rights. So what I'm saying is we can't say you're not allowed to transfer districts because of this. Because that's statutory. You're allowed to transfer districts under the emergency or open transfer provisions. But this doesn't create any new rights. And I would be, you know, very doubtful schools are going to be admitting a lot of new students right now. So I assume they would decline those transfers if there were, for some reason, a rush in transfers.
But it could be done. Is it muted?
Did you hear that?
Actually, I don't believe we... I have a question. Did we cover all of that, everyone? Okay. All right.
What was your question, Superintendent?
No, that's okay. Thank you.
Okay, so I want to make sure that I have accurately noted the board members' verbal changes. I have inserting internet prior to connectivity for all the instances of that, to just to clarify that equity applies not just to devices, but the access as well. And then in that provision on page 4, number 3, I have that we are reinserting board so that it will read local school district board or charter school, and to align with the rest of the language. And those are the only additions I have noted from board members. Are there any other points that you wanted to address prior to considering?
All right. I'll ask if there is a motion to approve as amended, and I will ask if there's any need to clarify that in anyone's mind about that oral amendment.
I make a motion we approve the amendment as stated in the rule.
Second.
All right, so we are voting separately on the amendment.
That would be one vote, correct, Brad?
Yes.
All right, so that is a motion to approve as amended. Is that correct?
Well, we haven't amended anything right now, so we're amending it with the motion is the way I understand it.
I believe that is correct.
Okay, then, so we have an amendment that we are considering with a motion and a second. Is there any discussion or questions?
We have no motions.
There was a motion by Mr. Flanagan to amend, but I will ask.
Ms. Bradley second?
Yes.
Are we including the amendment to approve?
No.
The entire rule?
Are we able to do that then, Brad?
Mr. Parker? The way I understood it, I'm sorry, the connectivity on my end is a little spotty at the moment, but from what I understood and gathered, there was a motion to approve the rule as amended.
Yes.
Thank you. And a second by Ms. Bradley. Then any further discussion? All right, please call the roll, Ms. Cheadle.
Yes, ma'am. Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobek?
Aye.
Superintendent Hofmeister?
Aye. Thank you. That motion does carry. All right. Very good. Now, I would ask the board if they are ready to take up the next item. Shall we proceed? All right. Item number 6-4 is also an action item, discussion and possible action to approve a COVID-19 alert system to govern health alert levels, school safety response and operations for the public schools of the state of Oklahoma due to the coronavirus and the global pandemic. At this time, Mr. Clark, I'll let you begin. And I think we have a presentation presented by Ms. Thompson.
Sure. Before giving a very brief overview of this item, board members, while I think it's certainly appropriate and respectful to be on mute while others are talking, I do want to ensure that for purposes of the Open Meeting Act, if there is any discussion among the board, that it be not on mute. So I want to make that remark. With respect to this item, board members, superintendent, when this body met in March, may seem like a long time ago at this point, but at that time, there were two emergency declarations in effect. Those being the presidentially declared national emergency and the state of emergency declared by Governor Stitt. Those declarations related to COVID-19 remain in effect today. certainly no secret and clear that COVID-19 continues to impact the state of Oklahoma and its citizens. On July 18th, the state of Oklahoma hit the 25,000 marker for positive cases that have been confirmed in the state of Oklahoma, with the transmission of COVID-19 continuing to elevate in the state, across the state, and with public schools set to return for the 2020-21 school year. This proposal that will be presented to you momentarily is being brought pursuant to the authority that is vested in this body by the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma and the statutes in Title 70. Those statutes include, and I will say they are set forth on the agenda, but of note specifically within those statutes and the Constitution is the authority and duty of this board to provide for the health and safety of school children and to adopt policies, procedures, and take action to administer and effectuate, ensuring that the health and safety of the school children is provided. With that said, at this time, I'll turn it over to Ms. Carolyn Thompson for a brief presentation.
Thank you, and welcome, Ms. Carolyn Thompson.
Thank you, Superintendent. And before I get started, I just want to make sure that everyone can hear me and that you can also see the slide presentation.
We can see the slides and we can hear you, so welcome.
Very good. Thank you so much. Good morning, board members, and thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the protocol proposal that is in front of you today. We will hit some of the main high points and then be happy to discuss, obviously, further in detail. For the members of the public, this presentation is posted in the board documents on our website, so you can reference that there if you'd like to follow along on your own. Okay, so first of all, just a high-level overview following up on what Brad had shared. This document defines requirements for school conduct, and many of these are requirements, based on the number of cases of COVID-19 per capita in a county where a school district is located. It's worth mentioning that many of our school districts cross multiple counties, but each school district has a primary county assigned based on where their district administrative office is, and that is the county under which they would fall in the system. So the data that we're using relies on the Oklahoma State Department of Health COVID-19 alert system that was recently released, we expect for the COVID-19 cases to be updated weekly, we will be meeting weekly with the health department to review these numbers, look at case-specific information for each district, and work together to provide the best recommendations to our districts as possible. So this document provides minimum requirements that districts are to follow, but districts, of course, may impose additional requirements or additional restrictions on top of what this document sets as the minimum. And it does include a couple of main areas, just to highlight for you. It includes both a set of requirements and some additional recommendations for instructional delivery, for various health protocols, the wearing of masks or face coverings for visitors in school buildings, and activities, including extracurricular activities, public gatherings that might occur at a school, et cetera. Okay, this is the breakdown of the various levels, and these may look quite familiar to you, as they do largely align with what the health department has put forward in their alert system. So districts in the green level would be those districts that have less than 1.43 cases of COVID, and this is, I believe, on a 7-day rolling average per 100,000 population. The next level is yellow and is, again, 1.43 to 14.39 cases per 100,000. For orange, we did feel that it was appropriate to split orange into two levels, really to try to provide a more focused approach as cases increase and to differentiate between a district that might be in a county that is really kind of nearing that danger zone, perhaps of large community spread, or in a level, orange level two, a district that is in a county that is really seeing quite a lot of community spread. And then red being the top level with 50 or more cases per 100,000. Okay, so I will cover just the highlights of each level and the requirements that are in the document, and then we'll be happy to discuss more in detail. So the green level is really our goal for all districts, and there are many counties, maybe I shouldn't say many, there are some counties that are in green right now, and this would really be where districts are able to implement fully the plans that they have prepared over the summer moving into the school year, but is to include all of the recommended best practices for mitigation of the virus. So things like hand washing and cleaning and social distancing, ensuring appropriate ventilation, all of those things are to be followed in the green level. So it's not a things as usual like they would have been last year, but taking all of the relevant safety precautions. But instruction, of course, in this case would be expected to be offered in person. We would still strongly recommend that masks would be in place for students, teachers, and staff, since we know that that can significantly reduce the spread of the virus, but not required in the green level. We would still recommend that visitors be limited in the school building just to prevent any, or to mitigate, I suppose, the potential for spreading of the virus. And then activities, any sort of activities would be allowable, but of course we would encourage districts to be very cautious, since having those large group activities potentially may cause a significant spread event. In the yellow level, again, we would still expect for school districts to offer in-person instruction. However, in this level is the introduction of a requirement for masks for students in grades 4 through 12 and teachers and staff. So it would not be required for students in pre-K through 3 in their classrooms, but would be required for them in the hallways and other common areas as they're moving about the buildings. We do include an exception for, of course, when students are eating, nap time for little kids, recess, and even in physical education classes, if you can accomplish social distancing. We also have an exception for if it is unsafe for an individual to wear a mask, if they have a significant medical condition, or for example, some of our special education students, it may be unsafe for them to wear a mask. But otherwise, it would be required for students in grades 4 through 12. And that grade band was picked intentionally, since research is beginning to show that students age 10 and over really act like adults in how they spread and contract the virus. And so that is why grade 4 was picked as kind of the beginning point for when we would want masks to be worn in the yellow level. Additionally, we would require schools to limit visitors to only those essential people that need to be on campus. So, for example, you know, obviously emergency personnel or a student needing to enroll in class and needs to come to the building, some of those sorts of things, but would limit outside visitors that might just be coming to interact with students for any given reason. And then we would recommend in the yellow level that gatherings, large gatherings in school buildings and assemblies and other events be limited. Okay, in the orange level one, again, remember that we have divided orange into kind of a lower half and an upper half, just to try to, again, differentiate further between where schools and counties might land. So in orange level one, we do recommend that schools would consider using alternative schedules in order to ensure that they can spread out students. So an alternative schedule might be something like an AB week, some sort of rotation of students, or a hybrid model where they have some students doing distance learning and others in the building. But the goal really would be to try to maximize social distancing in buildings, really bringing down the number of students and individuals that are in a building at any one time. We would ask that schools continue in-person learning for our special education students that may need that in-person interaction or in-person special education services, or others that may not be able to be served due to connectivity issues or something of that nature. We want to be sure that those students are being able to be served, even in a time when some students may not be in the building. And then we would allow personnel to continue working on campus as assigned by their district. It's not a requirement, but this is a marked change from what we saw in the spring, in that we know many teachers and staff need to be on campus. Teachers, many prefer to be in their classrooms, doing their work and teaching from their classroom where all of their supports are. And so we would allow that in this scenario. In the orange level one, we would require masks for all students, teachers, and staff. Again, there would be exceptions for meals, nap time, recess, PE if distancing is possible again, and exceptions, of course, for when it is unsafe for students or staff to do so. Again, we would require districts to limit visitors in the building. And in Orange 1, we would not allow buildings to be used for extracurricular activities where distancing is not possible. So there are many activities where students act individually and it's not like a contact sport, but things where they are able to accomplish that social distancing. So those sorts of activities would continue to be allowed in Orange 1, but maybe not some of our larger group gatherings or, like I said, maybe contact sports would fall here as well. Okay, in Orange Level 2, we would then require schools to use distance learning. In Orange Level 2, we are really seeing what would be a community outbreak of COVID-19. And so in this case, we believe that it would be best for schools to use full distance learning if they fall into this Orange Level 2 category. So they would be able to continue, again, in-person learning for special education students and others that are unable to be served. The requirement would be that they limit those students in the building to 25% of those that are enrolled at the school, so that we ensure that social distancing is achieved. But we do want to encourage schools to continue in-person learning for those that need it most. Again, personnel may continue to work on campus if that is desired by their district. For those that continue to be in buildings, masks would be required again, with similar exceptions as you've seen on the previous slides. Also, visitors would be restricted in this level as well, and buildings would not be able to be used for any extracurricular activities or any sort of public gatherings. We know a lot of our school buildings are used for all kinds of public events, and so those would not be allowed for districts that are in the Orange Level 2. Okay, and then lastly would be the red level. Obviously, we don't want to see any of our schools or counties end up in this level. You'll note that all of the requirements here in red are the same as in Orange Level 2. However, we would further reduce the allowable student population in buildings from 25%, as was allowed in Orange Level 2, to 15% in the red level. So I think with that, that gives you a high level overview, and I know there will likely be a lot of discussion and conversation. And so I'd like to turn this back over to Brad and Superintendent to facilitate that discussion and conversation. And I think, Superintendent, unless you want me to put it on a particular slide, I can stop sharing the screen, or is there a slide you'd want me to put up?
Yeah, you can stop. Thank you.
Okay.
And board members, you should have this color-coded sheet in front of you or emailed to you as well. It includes as well a kind of a table that puts some of this information in an easier format to review. So please, that is where you will find more than the PowerPoint, of course, in more detail. I believe this is also available right now on with the board materials for others to be able to view as well. Let me double check that. Is that correct, Mr. Clark?
That is correct. It's on the website.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just want to make sure board members have a chance to get to that. And I also very much appreciate each one who is serving on this board and the time that you have spent looking at this information. There have been iterations of this, but mostly the advanced work has been with those Oklahoma State Health Department professionals who have helped answer important probing questions that we have had as we seek to respond to this national emergency, but certainly in Oklahoma, COVID is felt, it's here, the path of the coronavirus is here, and we want very much to be able to open schools, but do that in a way where our children are going to have a lower risk because of the decisions that are made today by this board, and that we are sending an important message to our teachers and those who serve in schools that they are valued, and that we want to also demonstrate our willingness to show that level of protection in this very extraordinary time under both state and national emergency. With that, I will also just ask for now any discussion that you may have, questions that you have, and we will get started. Thank you. Mr. Clark, did you have anything more that you want to? Okay. So board members, how do you respond?
Joy, can you hear me good?
Yes, thank you.
I actually like these protocols, but as guidelines or suggestions, and I'd actually like to make a motion that we would use them as guidelines and suggestions and not mandates. And therefore, my motion would include changing words like requirements and restrictions to recommendations and strong recommendations.
I second that.
And is there any discussion?
Yes. I'd like to chime in there. You know, I think going back to the original point of discussion about the duty of this board to ensure the health and safety of school children, I think about things such as our accreditation process, where we're overseeing districts doing safety drills or immunizations that have to be up to date. Several measures that we oversee as a board to ensure the health and safety and protection of students. In a global pandemic, I think that the limitations or the recommendations, suggestions, protocols that are listed in this document are, to me, a bottom level of the floor of what we should set as expectations across the country. As we've heard from many parents and superintendents and district leaders, community members, there are many local communities that are already putting measures in place. And some that are exceeding and going even above what we have in this document as the floor. So I think that us setting the expectation is operating within the duties of this board. And it is, to me, critically important that we're providing structure and a framework in a time that is very unprecedented. To be honest with you, even as we have this discussion virtually about instruction and it being in person, we in March, you know, declared that school needed to not be in session, and we are in the midst of something that is far worse than we ever predicted. My fear, even in us putting out these guidelines, I don't even feel like this is enough. Children need to have a safe environment. Parents need to be able to trust that schools are able to provide that. And it is about the health and safety, and that's within the scope of our responsibilities and our allegiance to students across this state. And so I feel strongly voting against that amendment, because these protocols are necessary, and I really appreciate the State Department's efforts in putting this together to provide a necessary framework for some uniformity across our state.
Thank you for that. And I also would be against that amendment. This is a time for leadership. This is a time where the citizens of Oklahoma that are under compulsory laws to send their children to school have to have assurance that their children will have safeguards in place. What we provided for the board is graduated, and it's responding to the local context. I know that's very important to this board, and I think that all of those who hear the respect for local boards by this body appreciate that. But we also know that there is not an assurance that even communities where there are high community transmission will be in touch with the experts that we have spent hours and hours and hours working and are committed and will continue to work to keep the safety and well-being of our districts at the top priority with the time and effort it takes to glean all of the information for these kinds of critical decisions. They need to focus on learning. They need to focus on implementing, but they also have the opportunity to go above and to execute those plans. We are a body that is charged with that oversight, particularly in a time of high transmission. And what I want to remind this board, please remember, we are just at July 23rd today. And the idea of making a suggestion to schools is very different than saying, we recognize what's coming. We want to get to green. We want every county to get to green on this chart, which is part of the health department's alert system for COVID transmission. And when we are in yellow, that's the caution zone. So yellow, we really need to be careful that we mitigate that spread immediately. Orange is like the danger zone where it can get out of control quickly, and red is too late. We can't wait to act until it is too late. So we have this opportunity now to tell our teachers, no matter what school you go to, there will be a type of careful look at where we are in this transmission throughout communities and counties. And we will be sure that there is at least a minimum safety protocol in place. And with that, we have a chance. And I would suggest to you, we have a window right now that is going to close. And that window right now will be important in preparing and ramping up for the needed PPE, the needed masks, the needed hand sanitizing, the materials, the necessary efforts to social distance so that we can stay in school. But what is going on even before we get there is that our teachers are having to make a decision of whether or not they are going to put their own family at risk because of the work they're doing without a guarantee of minimum protections. And that does fall to the state board. We definitely are, I know, in a time where science is still investigating, And we are going to continue to learn about the impact of the virus and how to better protect ourselves. But what has become crystal clear is masks actually work. And they can shut down the virus. And if we had that opportunity as a board to ensure that that happens in Oklahoma, we have a fighting chance to see fewer people affected, fewer people ill, fewer people disrupted due to quarantine, and more of our children being able to learn face-to-face with their teachers and in their peer groups. With that, I would ask if you have other questions or other comments, board members.
Go ahead, Mr. Flanagan.
I've got several questions about, first, when you look at our rates per thousand, this in essence, I'm not sure where these numbers come from, but when like green, it's 1.43 cases per 100,000. So that is a very small number. And so how did these rates get on there, and how we confirm that they're not a mathematical error and we missed it a couple of decimal points?
This information comes from the State Department of Health, and it is how they report the information also to other agencies at the federal level, but they broke it down in these ways. Now, is it could there be a digit or a decimal off? I don't know the answer. We are relying on our work and meeting with them. This is what they've put forward. Okay. And we want to tie in with what they have.
Okay, let's just take red, for instance. So that's more than 50 cases per 100,000 students.
Per capita.
So if you take that out, it's 0.0005%. So if you had one student and you had a school district of 100,000, you would fail. And so I have real concern that if these measurements are really helpful for any party at this point, but I just wanted to point that out. And you go through each category, it's the same thing. It's much more restrictive than it appears to be in the normal circumstances. Also, these are averages too. And so when you look at the rates per county and you start looking across the state of Oklahoma, majority of Oklahoma is orange right now. And so that could be a real problem. I think the mask requirement is good, and it does limit the exposure our teachers, our administrators, and our students have. And so the mask requirement, it's strongly recommended that it apply. But in the final decision, when you start trying to make these on statewide basis with populations of 100,000 and no school district has those numbers, then you get in such small numbers, it makes these really very difficult to apply.
A point of clarification, is this the numbers that we're looking at and using that map? We're not using that map to apply to a school district, but to a whole county, correct? So
that's correct. These are the numbers as reported by the Oklahoma State Department of Health as they look at community transmission in a county. This is not about school enrollment and school size.
Okay.
This is about community transmission.
But then how do you apply that to an individual school district of medium size? How does an administrator take those numbers and apply those to their school district? Because part of their job is to mitigate risk. And there are certain things that, that they're doing their best they can to take that risk off the table. And inside their building or inside that school district may have an entirely fewer cases than in the county. And hopefully that's the case because of all the effort and the money that we've been spending to mitigate risk. Then why? So are we going to close the school district down when they don't have any cases?
No.
But the county is. So and how are you going to apply this to individual school districts is my question.
It's a really important question, and thank you for that. This is not about individual schools having to make assessments about who has COVID and who doesn't. And I can tell you, a local school district that lives, that resides inside a county that is at red level is going to already be closed because there won't be teachers. There will be so many people quarantined because of COVID exposure that you won't even have the ability to stay open. The goal here is to look at your county, and there's actually a definition that says that this is the definition for that. It's cases per capita into that take into account population density. So then there is a score, a numerical score for that transmission. And when it is in green, it is not at what is the active community transmission level. And so that is where we felt it was appropriate to say, that is a district's choice. Let's all get to green where it can all be that way. But we are rising, and the majority of schools are in yellow. So in yellow, board members, that would require a mask for those that the medical experts say at 10 years old, you now can get it and transmit with the same viral load as an adult. So we are thinking about both protecting other school classmates as well as the teachers that are teaching in those schools. Also, please remember that we are in a state in Oklahoma that should have a heightened sense of awareness that we have poor health outcomes for children. We rank among the lowest in the nation. That means we have more incidence of diabetes, of obesity, of asthma, and other comorbidities within our general student population. We are also seeing a surge of Hispanic students and children and families that have positive test cases in the metro area here in Oklahoma City. And I've been asked to help bring awareness to this because there isn't an awareness of how much masks matter in containing it. We know we have other populations that are going to be very at risk, but then there is everyone who thinks that they aren't at risk, who can take in that virus, transmit it to others, be asymptomatic, and respond with a healthy body in a very negative, tragic way. And that's what is the issue at hand. While the coronavirus is still a novel virus, we know that then this is allowing for that graduated system to take place. And by the way, yellow, as I mentioned, is the most common county level on the alert system. It is not orange. And there are no red counties today.
Board members, if I can chime in here, Mr. Flanagan, to your question, your point, there are required protocols within a school building. Those are CDC guidelines that have been issued and worked down to other levels of the state. But we know that schools are not a bubble. This is something that's proposed requiring a community investment to open schools, and not just open them, but keep them open. We know that, for example, an individual may travel from Loyal, Oklahoma to Dover to Cashin, all within a relatively short period of time. And that would be common in communities. That's just one example. Oklahoma City in the urban areas, certainly it seems to be more frequent there. This proposal is, we have the CDC guidelines. Those are reflected in the return to learn document, as well as this proposal. to adhere to those. Again, this is a proposal for the community investment to keep our schools open, our kids learning.
I have no doubts that the local communities are making those investments. I have no doubt that the superintendents of the schools are just as concerned as we are about the health of their kids within the system. I have no doubts that they have a better control what's going to happen with it as we go forward. That's unknown, but they are equipped to make those adjustments on a regular basis based on the facts on the ground and not based on the facts within a county. And I think this is also the color system is fine for information, but the final decision really needs to be left to the school district and the leadership within the school district. And they have the most current information about the status and the safety of those particular kids that they're entrusted with their safety. And so, and I really think the county-wide stuff is so broad that if you have a nursing home or if you have a meatpacking plant in your district and there's an outbreak in that, your county numbers will go through the sky. But the school may be completely okay. And so when you start getting into these mandates, you take that local control away to make the adjustments for that. So there's no reason, and once they identify the major source of the outbreak and it's not within the school system, then we're penalizing those kids.
I think that,
go ahead.
What you're stating, Bill, you know, about the outbreak not being within the school system, but when we're talking about the context of community spread, it would be a different conversation if we were talking about schools that were, say, boarding schools, where students lived and ate and slept in these communities, but our students go back out into the community. And whether it was at, you know, someone was at the Walmart or at the nursing home and coming in contact, as we're looking at a county level and as these parameters, as I mentioned before, I feel like are a floor, I think that it is in the interest of districts to even drill down, looking by census tract, and may find that there are measures that need to go above and beyond even what has been recommended by us. But I actually really see the context of community being critical when we're talking about a virus such as COVID-19 that rapidly spreads through the community. And that is what that chart is indicating to me is what is the risk within this county. But I absolutely agree with you that districts have to look at, you know, drilling down even deeper into their own data and might find that there's measures that must go above and beyond what is even being recommended.
Yeah, very, very good point. The other thing I did.
You take the infection rate for Rogers County, and it's 0.0044%, less than 1% from the inception of this COVID-19. Now, that doesn't mean that we ignore it. That doesn't mean that we kind of hide from it or so forth, but it does mean that when you can basically control it with masks and mitigate risk. That's a very small percent, and that's from day one, and that's monitored on a weekly basis. So,
and I take to heart what you're saying, Mr. Flanagan. One thing I would suggest, though, is you mentioned how many cases are in a particular area that you live and are familiar, but we don't know who has COVID. We don't even know after someone has taken a test for the determination of their test results with a great lag anyway. We are regardless going to, once we have a known positive in a school community, we are going to then follow CDC guidance and have to quarantine. And we're looking at children that are in the same class for more than 15 to 30 minutes with that individual being impacted with that quarantine. And not just that student, because now that student has to be at home, quarantined. And that is going to cause family disruption. And that's going to mean others are also going to be tested to ensure that they do not have it. But we're going to be waiting and waiting and waiting on those results. And then there are those who are not aware that they're carrying that and transmitting it. So we really don't know. That's why it is so important that we look at the community transmission. These numbers look really low, but it's because of what we now know, and the modeling gets better and better as we are able to make projections, that we are headed to a spike. There will be more and more and more cases. There will be changes that will be part of a person's life with underlying or long-term effects that we don't even know about yet. And so for now, we know that masks work. Now we know that they not only help the person that is wearing it by about 30% protection, but they give 70% protection when everyone else is wearing it. So it takes all of us doing it. So one person that is going to school with a mask on is really not even getting the benefit of that protection unless everyone has it on. And when we looked at how might we gradually move to respond to this in the recommendations, masks were key and central. They are the bedrock of safety protocols, along with hand washing and social distancing. And we know that we need to have those masks on because we're talking about children, and children aren't counting feet between one another. And there are many times when they're going to be close to one another, passing in hallways, changing classes in high schools. This is a bare minimum that we can give as an assurance to our schools, as there is now documented community transmission and the positive in the community is unknown. And that starts at yellow, where the majority of our schools are. But keep in mind, with clear guidance from pediatricians and those who are in the field of epidemiology, we are seeing permission to say that it is kind of a green light, that it is okay and permissible to allow those young children, pre-K through third grade, to remove that mask while they're in their own classroom and stay with that cohort if possible. And so we're trying to be flexible, but when we hit danger zone in orange, that's where it changes again for everyone. We have to be extra careful to halt the transmission of what we do not know yet. And that is the bare minimum for me, is the issue of wearing masks and ensuring that, so that our teachers, thousands of which, of whom are eligible to retire right now and are watching this board meeting, and they're making a decision on whether or not they're going to have protection guaranteed. And we know that we can't give any guarantees with these kinds of safeguards, but we can layer safeguards in such a way that it reduces risk to an acceptable level that is similar to doing our daily business in a careful manner, like going to the store and being diligent with washing hands. So that's all we're asking. All we're asking is for the bare minimum to ensure we can close this window and not see a spike that we know will be coming if it is unchecked in school.
If I might, this is Kurt Bollenbach. Without belonging or making the discussion longer than it needs to be, I would agree almost across the board with everything that Superintendent Hoffmeister and with Carlicia that they've said. I believe that at this point, the state across the board is looking to us for guidance. And I think also it is our duty to ensure that we are willing to provide leadership to step up and if it requires a mandate, that we be willing to make that decision. I think we have an opportunity to change our behavior, and we've all known the risk since March, and we have not, as a state, we have not changed our behavior. We across the board don't wear masks. Certainly in rural Oklahoma, where I'm from, that masks are not a part of our daily life. We come into Oklahoma City and we might put them on because it's required, but then we go back to our areas and it's just not a part of daily life. If we want to offer a safe environment for our teachers, for our students, and potentially change local behavior, I do think that a mask requirement is necessary. It's a minor inconvenience. Hopefully it's temporary. And it for the benefits, based on talking to medical experts, it's pretty big bang for the buck. That being said, I do, there is a constant balance in Oklahoma of state versus local control. And what I have read in the plan, I like it. The one area that I struggle is whenever different levels occur, it's not the mask mandates or even the requirements related to extracurricular activities. It's at what point are we taking away local control as to the decision regarding distance learning, hybrid learning, and are we inserting our belief on what should happen to the potential detriment of a rural school that maybe just does not have the ability to provide distance or hybrid at the same level as maybe a larger school district. Across the board, I really agree with the safety protocol. I really would like to hear what folks feel about the requirement of, and I think the requirements don't start until orange level 2 and red, those requirements of changing the instructional structure. And then also, I do want to make sure that I'm very clear, or that it's clear, because in the reading of this, I believe the intent is that the requirements to change instructional structure also does have an alternative. In other words, if you're in a community that has a meatpacking plant or a prison that has a high level of infection rate and you end up in orange level 2 or potentially even red, that a district is able to come to the state and local health officials and the State Department and say, hey, look, we have institutional spread. We really should not be going to a distance learning model or something like that. I want to make sure that it's clear that either there is an alternative or that is the intention on the whole, if that makes sense. But I do think right now is an opportunity that we really need to look at being our brother's keeper. I don't want to infringe on local control more than what we should be doing, but I also want to ensure that we are, as a state board, taking a leadership role in pushing out guidance and directives.
Thank you. And I'll ask Ms. Oh, excuse me. I was going to ask, I'm not sure who is speaking, but to your question, Mr. Bollenbach, it has come up also and it wasn't answered when I think it was also posed with Mr. Flanagan, but it actually does have a exception for when there is incidents like you described of institutional spread, which is different from community transmission, but it's institutional transmission. And that is why there is wording that describes that it is or as advised by local and state health officials and OSDE in orange level two, the very beginning. It is giving that clause in there to say, no, this is involving a prison where those numbers are reflected, and then that overrides that number for that county, okay? It could also work the opposite way. You could be in yellow and the Department of Health says, we are getting tremendous spike in this area and you need to be aware of that, and that would be the advice that you're going to have to change that behavior from where you are on that map. So that is in there for that reason. I hope that, I know that's hard to just see when there's so many pages in front of you. And then I can't tell who, but I believe I heard someone's voice.
Just it was as, me.
Is that Jennifer?
It's Jennifer.
Ms. Yeah, Money, hi. Okay.
I had a couple of questions. I'm sure it will shock Carolyn or anyone who is answering the questions. One of the main things that I have an issue with is communication and how this is going to be communicated to different school communities. And so to that end, Orange Level 2 doesn't exist at the state level. So whenever we are putting out, and I understand the reasons why, you know, we went through why it's been added. But as it's communicated over the news, over, you know, every Friday, the State Department of Health is going to be updating their map, and it's red, orange, yellow, and green. If I live in a county that is orange, how am I going to know if I'm level one or level two? And how is that communication going to happen so that it's clear to people to know what the expectations are come Monday?
Very good question, but that is actually not that big of a difference between orange one. So if you're in orange, you didn't just get to that orange two level that quickly. And it was a recommendation from those health officials on the State Department of Health conference group and collaboration that we began meeting with and are continuing to have standing meetings, that we make that break at 25. It coincides with others as well. Our list then goes to the districts. We have a spreadsheet that you download, and it just shows where they are and their number. So 25 is where it changes.
But, I mean, there is a big difference between, I mean, the difference between level one and level two and orange is the difference between closing schools, requiring schools to close. And so I have concern that Friday a district is going to move, you know, from level one, or move from yellow to orange level one versus orange level two, and how that's going to be communicated in a way that parents know what to do when they send their kids to school on Monday.
So if there is a change that drastic from all of a sudden, let's say yellow to orange level two, then you're right. That would be the same kind of thing as a snow day. Like there's an emergency. If there is a change from orange level one to orange level two, everyone's seen that coming. Districts have been planning and preparing. This is the floor. And they begin implementing those plans as they talk with their local health providers. And we continue to give through the state level that kind of feedback and guidance for them directly, meaning not we at the State Department of Education, but the State Department of Health in conjunction, we are a partner. So that is and it's also not happening.
Sorry. To me, it's the difference between 14.39 and 25. So it doesn't seem like that's something that would, it could be a surprise, especially if you're talking about a nursing home outbreak, a prison outbreak, something that happens. And so I think going from 14.39 to 25 is possible.
It certainly is possible, especially if there's not a mask mandate.
Okay, so my second question is looking at, so this is a map that has existed for 3 weeks. And we know that there's been a lot of data reporting issues. There's lags in data reporting that have been an issue. So looking at, and this is crude counting on my part, looking at the maps for the last 3 weeks, there have been roughly 10 counties that have gone from yellow to orange and back to yellow. So talking about consistency from a school district and communication to parents, within 3 weeks, they have gone from a situation where masks are only required for 4th through 12th grade to a situation where potentially their school is closed, to then back to only requiring masks for 4th through 12th grade. And so this is happening. There is volatility within these colors. And so I'm trying to wrap my head around what the communication is then. And if I am, and I do sit on a local school board, if I am a local administrator or a local board, how do I communicate to my parents what they're supposed to do whenever they come to school on Monday? With that much difference in volatility between the colors.
I wonder in that case, you know, of entering this discussion and what our top priority is, if it's the health and safety of students and parents are trusting in districts to be able to protect their students, what does it mean to set that as our number one? And in knowing that, you know, develop these channels for communication. I also think that the importance of this discussion happening right now in July and measures being adopted right now by this board is for districts to be able to plan those channels of communication, have conversations with parents to ensure that there are protocols in place to adjust. Ultimately, I think that the chart itself and the varying model of looking at rolling averages, because things change day to day, week to week, the numbers have changed probably right now as we've been sitting in this discussion, there is a necessity for us all to be able to adapt. But if I'm being really frank, I feel like the fact of the way that things are shifting and changing and continuing to move forward, there's even a concern about kids being in buildings at all, knowing that there's such a shift. I personally think that there might be some districts who look at this literally, as I've been saying over and over again, as the floor, and are able to provide options that provide much more consistency and security, looking at OKCPS of saying, hey, we're gonna do distance learning for the first 9 weeks, and then ease into this model. That is a local choice of a district that goes above and beyond anything that we're recommending, that provides a form of consistency. I see this example of what has been put forth by the State Department as literally a floor of guidelines to ensure that parents and staff and community members can trust going back into their public education systems, that there is someone and an entity that is looking at this across the board.
Board member.
I mean, I think I
go ahead.
Let Brad go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Brad. Go.
If it is helpful, board members, we're talking about the map, and Carolyn might be able to share her screen. I mean, I know I'm looking at it, and there is a lot of change going. Last week, I think the state had 4 counties in orange. I believe there are 18 now on that same time span. The number of counties in green has diminished as well. So I think it's clear that things are changing, but not in a positive direction. Thank you, Carolyn.
I would like to chime in. This is Estella Hernandez. And thank you for pointing out that map once again. It's so important for us to really refocus on what we're discussing. And I'm saddened that this has turned about 100% conversation on masks. I see it from a 30,000 foot view, and I think we need to also see it that this discussion is really about our republic. This is truly about an oath that many of us, all of us on this board took over a year ago, and our responsibility to upholding that oath, and that is of the Constitution. And one of the things that before taking that oath, with all of our elected officials, that we had to go through clearly a very rigorous approval process. They all talked about local control. They all talked about the importance of allowing our school districts, over 500 of them in the entire state, to be able to make decisions for their local boards and their local districts. And absolutely, for me, it is about 100% safety of our students. And on a personal level, I agree with the mask. I agree that we should wear a mask and that it's helpful to everyone that we come in contact with. But this isn't about a mask conversation. This is about, are we going to allow our democracy to be at work? It is really comes down to the heart of, it's about bottom up, not top down. And the more I hear many of us talk on this call, we're talking about top down. And that's not what Oklahoma and what this nation is all about. And I want to be able to refocus that, that it's about trusting our local boards to do what they're intended to do. And for that reason, I've been listening to our local experts. We called from with an epidemiologist who gave even, you know, higher mandates of what we should be doing. I don't want to give our schools the bare minimum. I want to give them more than that. And if we want to give them more than that, then we're going to have to start mandating so many other things. And for me, then let's refocus what our responsibility is, our constitutional duty that we took an oath to, and that is allowing our democracy to work from the bottom up. And it's for that reason that I second the motion to make that change, that it is highly recommended. And at looking at our local experts, I also look at our State Department of Health that is saying that this is also just a recommendation. And I urge you to go to the Department of Health site where they talk about our reopening of schools. They have three different steps. And three of the most important ones are obviously social distancing, hand washing, and we're making this conversation 100% about masks. They don't. This has to be different things balanced together to make keep everyone safe. And for that reason, I urge you to allow our local districts to decide. And we heard from parents earlier this morning, and they are telling us that they are having these decisions being made at the local level already. And why are we not allowing that to work? I refuse to make a decision top down and not allowing what we took an oath to and what we told senators and what we told parents. We told them that we would allow their local districts to make those important decisions. I hope we can go ahead and vote and second, and I second obviously Mr. Bobeck's motion.
Joey, I got two more questions. In the document, it says immediately through September 30th, 2020. Why did we not do all the way through the end of the year? We set this policy and it expires September 30th. Why didn't we go all the way through the end of the school year?
That's a very good point. The reason is because we need to revisit and come back and revise. Obviously, we've heard from some board members that want to set requirements, others that just want to give some ideas to districts. What if this is a set of a combination, actually? And so just like a governor's executive order expires 30 days after it is given, we also built in a safety net for revisiting that before at our September board meeting, and having the opportunity to say, you know what, actually this isn't enough, or well, you know what, we're doing such a good job here, and there's been more important, compelling research out that would have us move in a different direction. So it is a shorter term piece in that same spirit of these other, modeled after these other types of directives. Recognizing this is not permanent that we are in this pandemic, but this pandemic will go longer based on the actions of Oklahomans and those in our country that we take right now. We're seeing a spike because we dropped our guard as a state. There are people that kind of got perhaps overconfident that this wasn't going to be having widespread. And then we've seen that it has emerged as something greater. Our effort in this time period in July 23rd through September 30th is to say, let's talk about this period of time. But certainly, I understand your interest in having safeguards throughout the year.
And the second question I've got is, why didn't we consider given the mask situation in Oklahoma and trying to bend that curve a little more time and have a later start date for school for this year? If I understand it, a lot of schools are starting in August instead of in September 5 after Labor Day. What was the consideration there?
Yes, that was a consideration, and it was one in respect of local control. There are some districts that are they need to get with their students to be able to deploy any kind of distance learning connectivity and training on that, and they want to get started sooner. We are trying in this document to provide just the minimum when it comes to the bare basics of safety protocol so that districts can add to that and change that. The other thought that went into that is that we do expect that after the Labor Day weekend, we will see an increase again, because again, we are seeing risky behavior that affects all of us and our communities. And so this idea potentially of waiting in some communities would put them right in a much higher transmission to start at that point and then try to scramble to make connections with students. So the idea of giving more of that local control on calendars, they already have plans in place, they know what it would mean and the ramifications for them, was something that we felt, you know, that is too far. And as far as these recommendations, I'll not propose that, but that's something that the board certainly can consider.
And I go back to, I'm so sorry, but you mentioned that the reason why we did not propose starting later, which we have some districts who have already made that decision, is to respect local control. So then that's where we have to get into ourselves and saying, at what point do we respect local control and at what point do we not? When do we choose not to and when do we choose to do so? So that goes to the heart of what we're discussing, which is the reason why the expert, the epidemiologist that spoke, he said that it's going to peak in September and October. So we should be having these conversations further ahead, which I agree, it is the bare minimum. So I just urge you that let's go ahead and respect local control, not make it about the mask, but truly a balance on social distancing, on masks, washing hands, and being able to push that and have our local districts make that determination for themselves. I trust them. I don't know if you do, but I trust our local districts.
I think Carlisha has been trying to speak for quite a while. Go ahead, Carlisha.
Yeah, I mean, Estella, I appreciated your comments about the oath that we made. You brought me back to the experiences of, you know, over a year ago. And I think we've all been on a journey that we did not expect to end up at this point. I believe, for me personally, my allegiance and pledge was to operating in the best interest of the health, safety, and quality educational opportunities for children. And I would believe that the state board would not exist at this level if there was never a need for oversight of local control. I too trust our superintendents and our local board leaders. I also know that they are not health experts who have ever navigated the waters of a pandemic that we're in right now. I think about the level of time and preparation this board and our State Department spends with the list of guidelines that they even came up with. Think about that responsibility on top of preparing for high quality education, working through staff challenges and hiring and curriculum, all of those things. Our superintendents, local superintendents and school boards should be worried about providing that quality educational experience for kids. There are many times that this board has made decisions, whether it be on accreditation items that come across our way to provide oversight of local control. I mean, I really, again, see this opportunity in support of the oath that we made, in support of the promises and the pledge that we stood in that State Department office and committed to across many others. I personally, you know, don't think that this conversation is just about mask mandates, because there's several spaces in these guidelines that do support social distancing and, you know, all of the guidelines that are within the CDC, making room for districts to do above and beyond. I just think that it would actually be us operating not within what we pledged to do if we left today and did not at least ensure that there was a floor of safety and protection for students and staff members across our state.
And then I think, thank you very much.
I just think at the end of the day, I mean, I understand that, you know, we're asking a lot. We're asking a lot of this board. We've asked a lot of the State Department. I know a lot of effort and time and care has gone into thinking through this proposal. I think at the end of the day, I think of my kids' school. We're supposed to start school 3 weeks from today, and they literally are now on hold on creating their own plan, waiting to see what this board does, which I just don't think is what should be happening. Right. I think what ultimately makes the most sense for my kids' school and my kids' district is something that local board is going to best understand based on our building and our ability to social distance, based on our population of students and teachers. Surveys have gone out. I mean, we are in a situation where there are, and I wish I had the number, no one seems to know, but a number of districts, I mean, I don't know if it's hundreds or not, have their own plan that have already been put in place that this meeting and what we are considering here today may potentially put in chaos what's already been approved by a local board and district. And I just don't think that that's right. At the end of the day, this is something that is completely moving way too fast. We cannot put in place mandates at the state level that a local district is going to know what is best going on in their building and be able to be much more nimble than any kind of recommendations or requirements that we're putting in place. I agree with Brian. I think it's absolutely appropriate, just like we did with Return to Learn. There's great recommendations in here for school districts and what they should do when they get a positive case, what they should do, you know, as far as social distancing and how to put classrooms together. I think we absolutely should be putting out guidance to districts to help them make these decisions. But at the end of the day, I think they are the most close to it and should be deciding for their own district and their own community what is right to move forward. So I don't want to cut off conversation, but I mean, I'd like to press the motion unless there's other people that want to talk.
I have one last thing is, I worry that if, and I understand what we are saying about the need for local control. When I look at this, there's only really the two things that jump out to me are the instructional piece and then the mask piece that caused the most consternation. I do believe, certainly in rural Oklahoma, I can't speak for everywhere, but for where I live, the mask issue becomes a hot button topic. And I think that part of our duty can be providing top cover to local districts so that their issue is not yay or nay on mask, or that's what they're going to spend the next couple of weeks talking about. It's much easier for a district to say, this is coming to us and this is how it's going to be, because the state mandates it. I do struggle with the instructional piece, because I think the local districts understand the implementation of their instruction in their district. I would, and I don't know if we can have two motions at once, but I would make a motion that we amend the protocol as is, that the instructional portion be a recommendation and the rest of it be as is. In other words, the mask portion would be a mandate. The extracurricular activities would be a mandate, but the instructional piece, that's going to come back to the local district to make a decision. They can follow our guidance or decide not to based on their situation, but I think we provide them top cover on those other activities, such as masks, such as extracurricular activities, those types of things.
Okay. Ms. Dolenbach, board members, procedurally, I had a feeling that this might happen this morning or today. We do have a motion on the table and a second. It would be appropriate to take a vote on that motion, notwithstanding if Mr. Bobek, who I believe made the motion, if he was inclined to withdraw that or amend it. But procedurally, it is appropriate to take up that motion. If it were afterwards from that motion and a vote, there could be a motion to reconsider. If we can take that one up first, again, if Mr. Bobek was inclined to amend it or do something otherwise, but that would be procedurally appropriate right now.
No, but before we vote, I just wanted to reiterate that my motion is to utilize the protocols, but only as guidelines and suggestions, not as requirements, not as mandates, and any wording that's currently in the protocols that would require or mandate would need to be changed accordingly to things like recommendations strongly recommended. So that's the motion.
All right, we have a motion. We have a proper second. I believe, I feel I heard 2 seconds, but maybe I only heard a second from Ms. Fernandez. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on that? All right, please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
No.
Mr. Bolenbach?
No.
Mr. Flanagan?
Yes.
Ms. Hernandez?
Yes.
Ms. Moneys?
Yes.
Mr. Bobek?
Yes.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
No. All right, that motion carried, and that means that you now have a plan that is only recommendations from the state board. At this time, is there any other motion?
I would love to know what is possible for another recommendation or motion. If Mr. Bolenbach's recommendation is allowed, considering that it was not the full version of that proposal, I'm curious, Brad, to know more there.
Sure. It, procedurally, it would be a motion to reconsider, and to reconsider that vote, that motion, and take it up again if it were to be modified with the reconsideration.
I move that we reconsider with the modifications that Mr. Bolenbach recommended.
And Mr. Bolenbach, would you restate that?
Yes, I would make a motion that we modify the protocol as is to change the instructional portion, so the portion that's under the instruction headline or heading, to be recommended as opposed to any mandatory portions, but all else of the protocol stay the same.
I second that.
All right, we have a motion and that.
Can you please clarify that recommendation that you currently put forth? It's not clear to me.
Okay, I'm sorry. If you're looking at the protocol, there are portions in which would be orange level 2 and level 3 where districts are required to do certain take certain actions regarding instruction or the way instruction is delivered. And my suggestion is that we simply change those requirements to recommendations to the local district, and then the local district make their decision as to the way instruction is going to be delivered.
But what you're saying is there would still be mandates and requirements in the rest of the body of the protocols, is that correct?
That is correct. So the portion about health protocols would stay the same, the portions about masks would stay the same. And I think the most impactful outside of that would be the extracurricular and group assemblies portion. And I would be willing to listen to further discussion on any of that.
Brad, can I ask a procedural? Sorry, Estella. I was just going to ask procedurally. Shouldn't it be that we have to reconsider the vote by which something just passed? Can we reconsider and change it at the same time?
I'm sorry. There were multiple conversations going on. I didn't.
I'm asking from a procedural standpoint. Shouldn't it be only that we can reconsider by which the vote by which the previous vote passed versus reconsideration and changing it all within the same vote?
I'm not sure I understand the difference in the question, and I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be difficult, but I'm just not sure I understand.
So it is, the question is it proper to reconsider the vote with amendment?
Yes. Yeah. To me, that is the effect of the reconsideration.
So we have a motion placed by Ms. Bradley. We have a second by Mr. Flanagan. If there are questions, we can continue that discussion.
So I need to be clear that what Mr. Bollenbach is suggesting is overturning Mr. Bobeck's vote to changing the yellow and orange level 1 from the required to a strongly recommended, and leaving the mandated requirements on the mask issue. Because if it's procedurally, if we just voted on Mr. Bobeck's, we have to now move on to the next agenda item, and that's not on the agenda item.
Robert's Rules of Order authorize a motion to reconsider.
Yeah, but just to reconsider.
Yeah, just right. The reconsidering, though, Brad, by definition, that's different than reconsider and amend.
And take a vote. That means it needs to go on to next month's agenda.
It's different.
Well, I'm not sure what the purpose of a reconsideration would be 5 seconds apart from an earlier vote.
Agreed.
The previous vote was overturned in the reconsideration, then maybe the amendment could be made, but not in the same place.
I'm sorry, not
during the same action, Brad.
No. So we do, it's my understanding, we do have a proper motion and a second, but I definitely think it's very important that we answer any questions.
I have a I still, and I believe in masks. I believe that there are a lot of people and a lot of districts that put in place mask mandates based on their local community spread and decisions. I don't understand how, to me, it makes it even worse. I mean, that we're saying this piece we recommend and this piece we mandate. And at the end of the day, I just still think that this is something that is best decided at the local level. There are already districts all across the state that have put, we heard from three of them or more, I guess it was all of Cherokee County, and then both Piedmont and Middell in the public comments earlier. And I know there's many more that already have mask mandates put in place. I don't see why we need to say this piece is strongly recommended, but leave in a mandate. I think it should be decided at the local level.
And I think the credibility of this board is going to be compromised if we make a move like the one we're about to take, where we are abiding by Robert's rules, like you mentioned, and we just voted. And then at the same, within almost the same breath, we're overturning it instead of putting it back on the agenda and discussing this next month. We took a vote, now we're on to the next agenda item.
I think the, and correct me if I'm wrong, just procedurally, I tend to agree with probably Mr. Bobek and Ms. Money that if we're going to have a motion to reconsider for the purpose of having Carlicia's motion, we would vote to essentially reconsider Mr. Bobek's motion if the reconsideration passes. In other words, it's withdrawn effectively or vacated, and then we turn around and we can vote on Carlicia's motion, which would be the amendment as I suggested. But it would seem to me that that would be a two-step process.
Yes.
And otherwise, essentially, the amendments that I suggest really just won't be heard. And so the only way that they're going to be heard or voted on is if we withdraw the first action item that we took. Does that make sense? Does that sound appropriate? And so really it's the question of, I believe we should have a motion to reconsider Mr. Bobek's motion, the one that just passed. If the motion to reconsider fails, then we move on. If the motion to reconsider passes, then Carlicia will immediately make her motion, which will be the motion to amend as I stated.
So you're saying vote, are you saying to vote again on Mr. Bobek's motion?
We won't be voting again. We'll be voting on whether to essentially reopen discussion on that motion or just reconsider it or vacate it. And then we would move forward with Carlicia's. If Mr. Bobek is not reconsidered or withdrawn, then we're done and we move on.
Board members,
that
I provided. However,
can you say that again? It broke up.
Sure. I was attempting to say that I stand by the advice that I've given when asked this question, but I think it is cleaner to do it in two separate votes. If that's the way the board is inclined to go, I think that is cleaner to do it that way. I don't think it's required to be that way. And so I'm happy to answer about that. But.
All right. I feel better about that as well. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bobek and Mr. Clark. So then we would need a motion to reconsider and a second, and then we would take a vote to take that up. And then that opens the conversation for entertaining an additional motion.
That's correct.
So if the motion passes, then it basically is overriding what we just approved.
Not yet. It is opening up.
Well, okay, let me word that differently. If the motion passes, then it opens it up to potentially be overridden.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, no, not overridden. Not overridden.
Well, amended somehow.
To be added to, potentially.
Yeah. Okay.
So just so I'm clear, if you would vote yes, essentially we were going to have further discussion. If we vote no, then we're done.
Right. If you're voting no, then you're voting in favor of what we just passed. Okay.
Well, or right. we've already, correct. It is about whether or not we would reconsider. If there would be ability to reconsider that vote, that motion, right?
And if we don't want to reconsider, we would vote no.
Right.
Correct.
Can I make a statement about the intent of even the reconsideration? I think that, you know, we all have various perspectives. The reason why I asked for the consideration of another motion is because I don't feel that we had the time to deeply discuss Mr. Bollenbach's recommendation. We were simply looking at if it's mandating all or not mandating anything. And so that is the heart of the rationale and why I'm asking for consideration. I'm asking for, honestly, the safety and protection and well-being of kids, of staff members across our state. I keep saying it time and time again, guys. Like, it is our responsibility, not just morally, but also constitutionally, to provide some sort of guidance to support the safety and well-being of our kids. That is why I'm asking for the reconsideration, to see if there are any components of this model that speak to something that we would be able to provide back to districts to actually support them in this season of an unprecedented pandemic. That's my ask.
At this point, I want to withdraw my second, because we've really changed the motion.
I'm not sure that we have yet. I think it is simply procedurally, we have to separate the two so that the wording of the motion that Carlisha made was to reconsider and. And so instead it's first reconsider, and then the second is to, if possible, take up what is appropriate or not and offer that to the board.
Is there a motion to reconsider?
So moved.
Second.
All right. Please call the roll to reconsider.
Ms. Williams Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
No.
Ms. Hernandez?
No.
Ms. Moniz?
No.
Mr. Bobeck?
No.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Yes. All right, so that means now for this meeting, this discussion is over. Except what it means is that all of the protocol is as a recommendation to districts. There is no safety requirement of schools.
Superintendent, I disagree with that. We strongly recommend guidance and so forth, and so there's nothing diminished from it. It's just a matter of the degree. And so I don't think anybody here on this board is any less concerned, even after the vote, as to safety. And that includes all administrative personnel at the state level, at the district level, at the school district level, the teachers, and including the students and the parents. So everybody is bought into safety. The question is, what's the best way to get there? And this is only through September 30th, 2020. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flanagan, for correcting that, because I agree with you, and I respectfully will say that we just approved this. This is the safety protocol that we are strongly recommending all 500 plus districts to go about. So this body did take a proactive vote to be able to keep the safety of our students and of staff at the forefront, and giving our districts the ability to decide depending on the size of their districts, to do what is best for their district. But we do have a safety protocol, and we just approved it with that amendment of strongly recommending instead of mandating.
How is this document as a recommendation any different from the, I don't know, it was like 46-page document that the State Department released that, you know, school districts actually were able to build some of their plans around? So I think that, you know, for the record, of course, there's a concern from the State Department about health and safety. But I think that today was putting a seal on what we expect across the board to ensure that that's happening. This would be in addition to the document that already we had that had recommendations. So I actually don't see our inactivity of a decision to mandate something today as an elevation of our care concern for the safety of students. It just said, we gave you one more thing that you can choose to do or choose not to do.
Are we able to take a break? I think we're 3.5 hours in now.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Ollenbach.
Thank you.
Not to comment on the next item. I certainly think it's appropriate, but before we move on to that next item and consider overtaking local control, we might take a break here.
That's not cool.
Thank you. All right, we will be in recess. Let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll come back at 12:30. All right, we will be coming out of our break once we have our secretary back with us and we make sure everyone, our legal counsel is back. Excuse me. All right. Let's see if we have Miss. We'll wait for our secretary.
I'm present.
All right. Thank you very much. It looks like we have all of our board members back. Thank you. And thank you for the suggestion of a break. I hope everyone had a chance to get some water as well. All right, board members, we are now on to the next item on our agenda, which is item number 6C, presentation and discussion and possible action on quarterly report by Ulaga Tallala Public Schools as required by the board action that was taken on June 25th, 2020. Mr. Clark, would you please present to the board?
Sure. Superintendent, board members, that action that is reflected on the agenda, action that was taken at the June 25th meeting, just to quickly recapture, was threefold. One, placing Ulaga Tallala Public Schools on probationary status for the 2020-21 school year, also requiring a quarterly report to be provided to the board that starts today, and the final piece was a letter of public reprimand to the district, and so that middle piece there on the quarterly report, excuse me, is being provided to you today. We do have representatives from the school district here. If I might, I see Karen Long, counsel for the district, is with us. If I might ask her to take it from here, and if she would introduce who's present with us today.
Yes, I'm glad to introduce the representatives of the school district. In my office with me is Brian Wigington, a board member for the Ulaga Tallala School District. We also have on the line Don Tice, who's president of the board and who the state board heard from in June and also in October. And finally, we are joined today by Superintendent Max Tanner.
Thank you.
If you are ready for the report that's scheduled today, the board has decided that Mr. Wigington is going to make that report, and he'll make it at this time.
Are we ready? Superintendent Hoffmeister and the State Board of Education members. There are many responsibilities we have as local school board members, including governance of the school district, supporting its mission, representing members of our community, complying with federal and state laws and regulations, among other responsibilities. Our greatest responsibility is protecting the health, safety, and welfare of our students, coupled with an excellent learning environment every day. Since October of 2019, when our board received your October 10th letter, we have listened to your concerns. We understand that as a board and as a district, we must do better. The Board of Education and our leadership team has continued to address areas of concern since our last meeting with the State Board on June 19th, and we are committed to making positive changes and restoring the confidence of students, parents, and district stakeholders. Ulaga Tallala has a tradition of excellence, and we are not defined by the State Board's actions. We have been and remain fully committed to our students and families. School board members and school leaders have been and will continue to evaluate and significantly improve our procedures and processes for investigating student and staff complaints of sex discrimination and sexual harassment, with special emphasis on Title IX. We will seek guidance from the Oklahoma State Department of Education to ensure the new procedures meet the highest of state safety standards, and have already requested identification by the State Department of all assistance that the State Department can provide, the contacts for that assistance, and any special information necessary to access OSDE resources. At our July 13th, 2020 Board of Education meeting, we named a new Title IX coordinator. He is an experienced educator with a heart for children and a deep commitment to student safety and a willingness to tackle increased training of staff members regarding inappropriate statements or actions to or about students, and improved education of students regarding reporting to adults any actions of adults, including school employees, that make students uncomfortable. We have set up Title IX and investigative training on August 3rd for all school administrators, and this training will include new Title IX federal regulations that go into effect on August 14th of this year. Our school administrators will be among the first school administrators in Oklahoma to receive training regarding the new federal Title IX regulations. Training will be provided by OSSBA attorney and certified Title IX trainer, Brandon Carey. In addition, on August 13th, our teachers will be provided professional development on Title IX and reporting. New policies have been developed and presented to the Board of Education on sexual harassment, child exploitation, and professional conduct by teachers and staff. We have approved student pamphlets to be handed out to each student the first day of school. These pamphlets will also be displayed at each entrance of the school, added to our student handbooks, and mailed to every parent of school-age students in our district before school begins. Our Title IX coordinator, as part of his Title IX responsibilities, will also oversee site administration decision-making of personnel hires, investigations, and terminations. Our coordinator will also oversee all personnel and student complaints. Other training will include instruction regarding the district's expectations for professional conduct in and out of classrooms, as well as the mandatory requirements, which we trust will be more fully explained, for reporting concerns to the Oklahoma State Department of Education. We have requested and expect to receive specific written instructions from a representative of the State Department and the State Board regarding who is to report to the State Department of Education and the State Board of Education, when the report is to be made, what actions the State Department will take upon receipt of an initial report, and clarifying Superintendent Hoffmeister's interpretation of Senate Bill 711. In seeking this clarification, we fully understand the potential legal jeopardy to state board members and the Ulagatsalala Board of Education for ill-timed involvement in a personnel investigation, even one involving student allegations of sexual harassment, if information is shared in violation of laws that restrict the time, place, and manner of disclosures. This is especially important for Ulagatsalala board members. Board members are schooled early and often by OSSBA not to be involved in or interfere with administrative investigations of wrongful or unlawful employee conduct. Teachers possess due process rights that include the right to a hearing before the Board of Education. The Board of Education is to be an unbiased hearing panel, but if a board member has been involved in receiving information involving third parties in the investigation, and forming early conclusions regarding the employee's guilt, then the board member must not serve on the hearing panel. In serious cases of board member misconduct, the school district may be required to retain a teacher it otherwise would have dismissed. We know that many of our families are concerned that the district's probationary status with the State Department of Education will diminish the quality of their child's education or the validity of their coursework and grades. Please be assured that we will work hard to improve in every area identified, and we will provide a quality education to our students as we have in the past. Their learning will not be interrupted because of this situation. There will be no staff member who is unaware of existing and new policies that make it crystal clear that allegations of sexual harassment of students will be promptly investigated, parents notified, and decisive action taken. And within the bounds of the law, reports will be made by the administration or the Board of Education to the State Department and State Board. As school board members and school leaders, we will oversee the development and implementation of this improved safety plan. Additionally, we will take all steps necessary to protect and respect students, to regain full accreditation with the Oklahoma State Department of Education, and to strengthen trust with our students, parents, staff, and school and education community. We believe that the board approval and administrative implementation of new policies, increased training of staff, focused education of students and parents will ensure our schools are safe and welcoming for every single student. This will be the forefront of every decision we make. We are honored to serve Ulagatsalala students and their families. To be clear, we agree that would-be educators and school leaders who disregard students have no place in public education. They have no place in our school district. Our board has consistently sought the maximum discipline in instances involving employee abuse or exploitation of students. We have also respected legal boundaries that dictate when a board member may have access to and review information regarding district employees so they can faithfully meet their obligations as ultimate district-based judges of teacher misconduct charges. This concludes the report.
Thank you very much. Board members, are there questions that you have of the board and this report?
I had a question. Ms. Long, previously you had served as an investigator in regards to some Title IX violation complaints. Are you still acting as an independent investigator for the school, or are you now representing the school district itself?
I have always been, as a lawyer for RFR, and because RFR is the district's retained legal group, I've always been an attorney for the district. They asked me to serve in a special capacity when I investigated their policies and procedures and made recommendations to them, but those recommendations were made as an attorney. I continue as one of the attorneys that serve the school district.
Going forward, if there are Title IX violations or allegations of a Title IX or similar type violation, will you serve as the investigator or will you be advising the district?
I don't think there's been a decision made regarding that. I can tell you about the Title IX structure is that in Title IX cases,
what I'd like to know is whether that decision's been made by the district. I'm asking you, will you be serving as an investigator or do you see your role as representing the district?
That's not for me to say because usually there's not a difference between the role of the district and what goes on in the investigation. Those decisions regarding who investigates are made on a case-by-case basis. There can be a minor matter where there's no need to have somebody from outside the district come in and investigate. There can be a major matter where the district does involve legal counsel, or as is often the case in major matters, you get somebody who is neutral and independent, not affiliated with the law firm, who comes in and conducts the investigation, but it's a case-by-case decision.
So as to the allegations that have previously been for the district, where you've been an investigator, do you consider those to be major allegations?
Are you talking about where I did the administrative review of past instances that were the target of the state board?
Yes.
I considered all of those instances to be major within the context of facts presented within those cases. And to be clear, I also believe that the district took prompt and effective steps that they could be taken when you consider what the laws are that are in place that protect teachers, that protect students, and that determine what hearing rights, particularly teachers who are considered career, or you might think of them as tenured teachers, have. It's a complicated environment.
Ms. Long, hang on. Ms. Long, I just want to be clear. I understand the personnel laws, and I am not asking anyone to violate those. But as the Title IX lawyer or the advisor to the school, I think, are you aware of the state statutes, the federal guidelines of reporting alleged child abuse allegations involving teachers and students? And there is an immediate requirement. There are criminal acts. So before we worry about personnel actions, I hope that the district is getting advice on the effects of potential criminal acts.
Oh, absolutely. On sexual abuse, sexual exploitation, duty to report to law enforcement, the duty to report to DHS, and you might be interested in knowing that every one of these matters was reported initially to law enforcement. Everyone.
Okay, so what is the duty to report it? What is that duty to report? Is it one day, immediately, weeks, months? What is the duty to report it? What's the time limit?
The expectation to report matters that appear to be criminal to law enforcement would be immediate. The expectation
okay, so,
to
so
to DHS
in your report, immediate. In your report, hang on, in your report that you gave us, the reporting did not happen until the state board found out 5 weeks later. And you just said that you felt like that was reported timely. Do you think that waiting 5 weeks for the State Department of Education to find out, do you think that is reporting it timely to law enforcement, a potential criminal act?
Well, the timely reporting to law enforcement, it was made immediately in every one of those instances, including the last one. It was made on November the 5th to law enforcement. In one of the instances, I think there was a delay, and I reported that to this board. And there was a delay of at least 11 days before that report to DHS was made.
I'll wait to see if I have any further questions.
Is the new Title IX coordinator, is that the assistant superintendent, Mr. Sappington?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And does he have any background, or I know he's got background academically, Mr. Whittington told us, but what about in Title IX, in regard to Title IX?
He has not had previous background in Title IX to date, but he has made arrangements both through education through OSSBA, and arrangements are being made for him to have a significant education in Title IX.
I know with all the horrific acts that have occurred over the past 5 years there, I know that creates some unrest in the community.
Sure.
I know Mr. Tice is on the phone, the board chair, board president. I'm curious to hear from Mr. Tice his feelings on where the community is at this point in starting to build their trust back with the school district to feel safe to come to school. Mr. Tice, how would you say they feel at this point?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Making sure you could hear me. And yeah. The question is, how do I feel the community is doing as far as moving forward?
Yes, sir. Their trust in the school district and the trust that their kids could go there safely.
I believe they feel that they can go there safely with the number of kids who have enrolled and are ready. And of course, with given the situation as such, everyone is still curious as to how that's going to be accomplished, whether it would be through a virtual or in person. But at this point, I see that there are a number of students who are ready and have enrolled and are expecting to attend.
Okay. Thank you.
You mentioned that the board chair is also on the line. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, that's Mr. Tice.
Okay. Mr. Tice, this is Estella Hernandez, and I have a question for you. The attorney in our last meeting made several recommendations that this body felt that could have gone a bit more and could have provided greater guidance to your district. Do you feel that that was enough guidance provided from that attorney, which we do have also on the call. Do you feel that that is enough guidance that she's provided? Do you need more? Where do you stand right now on that? And has the board taken an action to approve those recommendations from the attorney?
Yes, we have. We have adopted those actions, and we are also, there are some policies that have been given first reading, and at the same time, the board has requested and has scheduled with the OSSBA attorneys to be involved in Title IX training throughout the district. And at this time, yes, I believe the guidance is being provided. The one question we have is, there was reference from the State Board of Education regarding the assistance that they had in those particular matters, and we have asked in writing if we might be able to know what those items are in order to make sure that we have access to those, and that we, if we have not, that we obtain it and be able to ensure that we have all information that is available.
Board members, Mr. Tice and Ms. Long are correct. Ms. Long did email me, I believe it was Tuesday afternoon, requesting some clarification. I might be paraphrasing, Karen, if I am there, on the reporting requirements under Senate Bill 711, as well as any other reporting requirements. I respectfully asked at that time if I could answer those questions at a later time to focus on the returning recommendations that we discussed earlier. I think in a general sense, there under Senate Bill 711, there is a mandatory duty to report when an individual has been recommended for termination and then resigns. So again, we'll address those in more detail if we're able to in the very near future. But I think in the October meeting, board members, you will recall Mr. Tice and Mr. Tanner stating that, quote, they've got this. They will be reporting to the state board on any instance going forward. And so there is a difference between the two reporting requirements. But on the one hand, the individuals sat in front of this body and said that they had this under control. And Mr. Tanner, not 10 days later, was advised of a complaint of sexual exploitation or harassment and did not report that to this body. So those are the differences between the two. There was a legal duty under one, and perhaps that was not complied with because it was not required. But again, Mr. Tanner and Mr. Tice advised this body that they had this matter under control and knew how to report and would be doing so right away.
Brad, can I ask one question on that? Is it correct that they did report that to this board prior to a fifth incident occurring where that did not happen in a timely fashion?
I'm sorry, Ms. Moniz, will you ask that one more time?
Reword it.
So you just said, as far as that they came to this board, which I agree with, that and said that they would report to this board immediately any incident that happens, and then another incident did happen and it took 5 weeks for them to report it to this board. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
Karen, this is Bill Flanagan.
Yes, sir.
Can you also supply us actions that y'all are planning on taking in the future as far as education and so forth, and who is to do it and when, and kind of keep us updated that that scheduled education process is continuing?
When you started your question, I lost it. After you said, will you also supply us?
Just a schedule of future compliance that you've already taken but hasn't occurred yet as we go forward?
Sure. I think the district would be glad to supply that on a schedule and in whatever format you would desire.
Whatever format you can come up with, it's fine.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, I want to thank you for a very thorough presentation and the steps that you have taken, particularly in hiring someone to be the new designated Title IX coordinator. We are always aware that sometimes people are wearing many hats, and this is a position, a role, it's actually a federal responsibility that unfortunately I have concerns that in many districts we have a lack of appreciation for the role, the federal responsibilities, the moral responsibility as well. And it is one that we are striving to increase the awareness of those that are in positions of local school board members and those who serve in district leadership to have a better understanding. But nonetheless, whether it is understood at present or not, when you have students, we know that means you have to be in compliance and ready. And I just appreciate that this particular step that you've taken to revisit who is wearing that hat. And it clearly, you have made that a important role and have included training that goes with that, with this new designation for this new hire. So if I'm mistaken that it's a new hire, but whomever is in this position that you have now newly appointed, I think that is a positive outcome of this report.
Thank you. Those comments are very much appreciated.
Yes, I have a question also. Not that we can believe everything that we read in the news, but there had been some information publicly lately about Mr. Tanner's status. What is his status with the district, please?
Yes, Mr. Tanner will remain the superintendent of the school district for the 2021 school year. He has submitted his resignation and the board has accepted his resignation effective June 30. Of this year. He actually had an additional year remaining on his contract. It was scheduled to end June 30 of 2022, but instead will end at the end of the current school year.
Mr. Tanner, will you be carrying out the normal activities of the superintendent for this remaining school year? Is that what we're understanding?
I will keep serving as superintendent here, releasing the, the employment, the terminations, the Title IX to Mr. Sappington.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Then, board, is there any other questions or comments on this report? All right, I don't see any. Thank you very much for the report, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Board members, we now are on item number 6, part D, but before that is, with that is a consideration for executive session because of the matters that would be discussed as posted. And I would ask Mr. Clark if you have a recommendation to go into executive session.
We do, Superintendent. Board members, at this time we would ask for a motion to convene an executive session to discuss the matters identified on the agenda.
So moved.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Please call the roll.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, we will go into executive session. Board members will ask for direction from Jeremy Irons, but I believe we should mute our mics and also take away the video at this time.
Board members, you will actually have to leave. I think others may have hopped off, but you will have to leave this meeting and proceed as the directions and the emails that were sent for executive session.
All right, thank you. But we actually are just holding by putting it on, or do we exit?
Board members will exit to convene in a separate session.
I see. Thank you. All right, we are preparing to open as soon as we have those members who are physically present in the boardroom with their audio and visual on, we'll be able to proceed. There we are. All right, very good. At this time, we need to have a motion to come out of executive session. Is there a motion?
No move.
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. Please call the roll.
She's on mute.
Unmuted. Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bollenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, we are out of executive session. Let the record reflect that no votes were taken or motions issued during the time of executive session. I believe we had one guest that the record should reflect, which was Lori Murphy, who is also in executive session.
Talena was there too.
Oh, was Talena still in there? Yes. Okay, I thought I heard she was already gone. Okay.
Full legal team today.
Full legal team, got it. Now, board members, is there a motion that you would want to present at this time related to item number 6D?
I move to revoke the teaching license for the four people on the agenda.
Second.
Okay, let's take a roll call, please.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bolenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. Thank you. That motion carries. Board members, at this time, we do need a motion for the final item, which is 7, that is to adjourn. And I appreciate very much all of those who joined us and for the time that this board has given to thoughtfully deliberate and read lots of mail that I know you have received as well, and studied all these documents in many of the action items that we had today. So at this time, I would move for a motion. Is there a motion to adjourn, I should ask?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, thank you. Please call the roll as is required when we do video board meetings.
Ms. Williams-Bradley?
Aye.
Mr. Bolenbach?
Aye.
Mr. Flanagan?
Aye.
Ms. Hernandez?
Aye.
Ms. Moniz?
Aye.
Mr. Bobeck?
Aye.
Superintendent Hoffmeister?
Aye. All right, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, board members, and please have a safe day. Take care.